Fisher, German bite, Humber, south or southwest.
Handcrafted to soothe your soul. The Sleeping Forecast. Listen on BBC Sounds.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Sunday, the 1st of September. This is Tom Sanders. Good morning. A mass rollout of polio vaccinations is due to begin in Gaza. Health officials working alongside the United Nations are aiming to inoculate hundreds of thousands of children under 10. The first case of polio in Gaza for a quarter of a century was confirmed last month. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, John Donison, reports.
Both Israel and Hamas have agreed to pause fighting in central Gaza between 6 o'clock in the morning and 3 in the afternoon local time. The first pause will last 3 days, with the United Nations saying it could be extended for a fourth day if needed. The vaccination campaign will then move to other parts of the Gaza Strip. UNICEF says it's aiming to vaccinate 640,000 children and babies in total. The first case of the highly infectious disease, which causes paralysis, was confirmed in a 10-month-old baby last week. Meanwhile, the Israeli military has confirmed the bodies of 6 hostages being held by Hamas have been discovered in Gaza. It says they were found in a tunnel in Rafah.
Voting's about to begin in 2 elections in eastern Germany, where the far-right AfD party is expected to perform strongly. It's anti-immigration, wants to replace the euro with a Deutschmark, and opposes the national government's approach to the war in Ukraine and climate change. One of the polls is taking place in Thuringia. Our correspondent Jessica Parker is in the state capital, Erfurt.
These are regional, not national elections. Regardless, the result could be seismic. Polls suggest that the far-right Alternative for Deutschland is leading in Thuringia and running a close second in Saxony. But because the AfD is viewed by many as extremist, an absence of willing coalition partners is likely to keep it from power. In Thuringia, the party is headed by a highly controversial figure, Bjorn Höcke. He's a talisman of the AfD's hard right and was fined twice this year for knowingly using a Nazi slogan, which he denied. Predictions also suggest the vote could be a major repudiation of the three parties governing Germany under Chancellor Olaf Scholz.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has again defended the government's decision to cut winter fuel support for around 10 million pensioners in England and Wales. The payments, worth up to £300, will be given only to those on pension credit or other means-tested benefits. Ms. Reeves said the policy would help put the country's finances on a firmer footing. Here's our political correspondent, Nick Eardley.
When Parliament returns tomorrow, it will be against the bleak backdrop of a Prime Minister warning of tough decisions to come. Some Labour MPs have told the BBC they fear the government is being too gloomy. There is particular concern about the winter fuel payment. MPs have told the BBC they think the government has misjudged the situation and that some sort of mitigations for pensioners not on benefits will have to be announced. The Treasury is likely to extend a hardship scheme which gives councils in England funding to help with the cost of living. But the Chancellor, as things stand, isn't budging. She writes in today's Observer that it was a tough choice she did not want to make, but was essential to put the country on a firmer footing.
The SNP's leader, John Swinney, will use his party conference speech in Edinburgh later to set out his legislative plans for the year. His priorities include ending child poverty, reaching net zero, delivering strong public services and boosting the economy. But Mr. Swinney is expected to warn the SNP will need to work harder and smarter to deliver for Scotland because of cuts imposed by Westminster. Airports in nearly 30 European countries which had scrapped limits for liquids in hand luggage have been told they must put the restrictions back in place. The European Commission says the reintroduction is a temporary measure to address a technical issue with new equipment. The UK has already taken a similar step. Here's our transport correspondent, Katie Austin.
Some European airports, such as in Rome and Amsterdam, had already brought in high-tech scanning machines which should allow liquids limits to be eased and laptops to be left in bags. But now no airports in the EU will let people take liquids through security in containers larger than 100 millilitres. Announcing what it described as the temporary measure in late July, the European Commission said a technical issue needed to be fixed. Some regional airports had already relaxed their rules but were suddenly told to bring back the 100 milliliter limit with no end date given. The Department for Transport said it was working with manufacturers, airports and international partners to lift restrictions when possible.
The British tennis player Dan Evans has been knocked out of the US Open at the third round stage. He was beaten in four sets by the 10th seed Alex de Minaur. The match was level at one set all, but Evans tried and lost the final two sets without winning a game. The result means Jack Draper is the only Briton left in either singles competition at Flushing Meadows. BBC News.
I'm Tim Harford, and on More or Less, we make sense of the numbers we hear in the news and in everyday life.
300 million tonnes of beef, even just in the UK.
Seems a lot, doesn't it?
We're here to answer your questions.
Is it true that the UK is growing faster than almost any other major economy?
And I've enlisted expert help to get us to the right answer.
This'll surprise you as much as it did me, that actually most people don't spend quite that much every week.
These numbers do not add up.
The new series of More or Less, with me, Tim Harford, Wednesday mornings at 9 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
This is BBC Radio 4. Good morning. You might have seen fields of its yellow flowers around the countryside, but oilseed rape is not the easiest crop, as Rebecca Rooney will be finding out in half an hour in On Your Farm from the Cotswolds. Before that, In Touch is one of Radio 4's longest-running programmes. In a special documentary, 50-50 Vision, Peter White looks back on changes in blind people's lives and forward to how technology might make a difference in the future.
That's the sound I would have made 50 years ago when I wrote my first presenter script for In Touch, Radio 4's programme made by and about blind and partially sighted people. As some of you will know, the programme is still going. More surprisingly, so am I. And so is the machine. But this is how writing the script sounds now. It's almost silent digital successor. Technology lies at the heart of many, though not all, of the things which have dramatically changed for visually impaired people over those past 50 years. And later in the programme, I'll be exploring some of those changes with the people they've happened to, assessing their consequences, good and bad. But we at In Touch have also had a lot of fun along the way, as we've enjoyed shocking people by demonstrating that, whatever the public's image of blindness, there's very little in this world we won't have a go at. Who knew, for instance, that there was a blind land speed record? This is Mike Newman, breaking it.
Today I've managed to convince someone to lend me a £150,000 car and I can't see and I've raced it at 200 miles an hour.
Welcome to your BA flight today. I'm your captain, Peter White. We've done all the checks that we need to do. And by the way, I'm totally blind as well. So sit back and enjoy the flight. What do I do now, Claire?
Oh my God.
Watch your eyebrows, Sue.
Yeah, I do the top of my lemon tart with this. And it's much easier because I can see what's going on. Well, I think I can see what's going on. I'm still trying to think what this thing is called.
I think blowtorch was the word visually impaired cook Sue Arnold was groping for there. I also want to look forward to the next 50 years with someone just starting out. 16-year-old Sasha McBride isn't sticking to the career ambitions usually considered suitable for blind and partially sighted youngsters.
I really would love to become a doctor or go into medicine. I don't think I'm allowed to be a surgeon at all, really, in some fields. Like neurosurgery, nah, that's locked off to me.
More from Sasha later on.
Welcome aboard this Northern service to Sheffield.
As I was setting out to conquer the world of broadcasting back in the 1970s, another young man with an intriguingly similar background to mine was setting out to conquer the world. Born 12 days apart, with the identical genetic cause of our blindness, both sent to special boarding schools at the age of 5, and both unwilling to accept the limited and limiting prospects on offer to blind people. I started with local radio. He started with the City of Sheffield.
Welcome.
How do you know we're friends, David?
This is Barley, it's not as bad as you.
Hello, dog. When you were emerging from kind of school and that, I want you to describe the world that you felt you were emerging into as far as, you know, blind people and prospects for blind people were concerned.
Prospects, as you and I knew to our cost, were pretty dire. And the attitude, the aspiration, the expectation of what we could achieve was very low, wasn't it?
David Blunkett, now Lord Blunkett.
We didn't do academic exams from the college I went to. That we did shorthand and typing, which I took because I didn't have an aptitude for piano tuning. But I knew if I could type word process as it is now, I might get somewhere. I think it was almost my determination not to be laid low by not being able to see. Something inside drove you, something inside drove me.
We haven't rehearsed this, I'm going to promise people, but do you remember the first time we met?
No, I don't. No, I don't. I'm really sorry.
Well, I do.
Why?
Because it was a meeting which Thina Heschel, producer of In Touch, organised about programmes for blind people. And you said, I don't think there ought to be programmes for blind people.
I do remember that.
Do you?
I do remember that. Yeah, I was really arsy. I hated the idea that we were going to be categorised, that we were going to be put in a box and we'd have a special programme. Now, I think it's a damn good idea that so many people listening have sight and begin to understand what the challenges are, and it's part of integration.
Of course, I disagree with David's initial sentiments about In Touch, mainly because, to tell the truth, I wanted the job of presenting it. The catchy signature tune soon disappeared, but the philosophy of the programme, nothing about us without us, remains to this day. That tagline summed up the belief of Thina Heschel, the producer who hired me and under whose beady eye I learnt my trade and gained so many other broadcasting opportunities, culminating with being appointed the BBC's first disability affairs correspondent. At last, in the 1990s, disability had stopped being featured on news bulletins only when some celeb had walked from Land's End to John O'Groats to raise money for a charity, or when there was news of some miracle cure, and started to be about our rights and the fight for equal treatment. And that led to my proudest broadcasting moment, and my mum's.
A bill which, for the first time, makes it illegal to discriminate against disabled people is set to clear its final hurdle in the Commons later today.
High on their list of demands is an end to what they see as discrimination on transport and in employment. Later this afternoon in the Commons, they'll be attempting to steer a course between the demands of disabled people and the anxieties of business. Peter White, BBC News. The passing of that act and the changing of attitudes to disability also led to some tough questioning of ministers, including my old sparring partner, David Blunkett. Do you remember the first question that we asked you when I came in to do the interview with you?
I do remember you coming in, because it was fairly soon. You know, I was elected as a minister in 97, and I think it was certainly in the first few weeks.
10 days. I'm going to play you the first, as you can't remember what it was.
I didn't say I couldn't, but you got me there.
Well, can you? You can't.
No,
you
can't, I can't, can so no, play it. No.
Let's go to the first question from a listener. Jane Vernon is a barrister. She practices in London.
Mr. Blunkett, why have you remained silent on the issue of disability rights, and how would you answer the charge that you've done as little for disabled people as Margaret Thatcher did for women?
Well, I thought it was a damn good question. And the answer, you know, is twofold. One, I believe that campaigning on issues relating to disability is everybody's business, and I wasn't going to be typecast. And secondly, if I had been the campaigner for disability, I wouldn't have been the Secretary of State for Education and Employment. And so I was really resistant to the concept that a blind person should look after blind people.
And all the while, the serious business of In Touch went on. Since its early days, the programme has reported on everything relevant to blind and partially sighted people. Living independently, the fight for welfare benefits, progress in eye treatments, the barrier to getting into and keeping work, and of course, linked to all of them, tracking the relentless march of technology. At this point, I have to admit that I have not been the ideal trailblazer in this field. Just about anything more involved than that old machine you heard at the beginning of the programme causes a thick fog to descend over my brain. But I, and many other blind people, have benefited enormously from the digital revolution. If you'd asked me at 18 what changes I wanted to see over my lifetime, I know exactly what I would have said. Vastly improved access to books in Braille, from the tiny number available back then to the situation I have now. Access to almost any book in a digital form that can now easily be converted into Braille. Since then, very few aspects of our lives have remained untouched by technology. I'm not qualified to sum them up for you, but I know a man who is. Jonathan Mosen's internationally respected website and podcast ranges across the issues that concern us.
I think the first big breakthrough we had was when we could write something down and read it back using text-to-speech and ultimately refreshable Braille. So to be able to write something down and then print that off so that it could be read by a sighted person. For me, the big deal was access to newspapers as well. When I was a child, I pestered my sighted siblings to read newspapers to me. It was the only way I could get them. And now I can, accessibility permitting, read any newspaper in the world. It's amazing. Banking with independence and dignity. I'm sure that, Peter, you would have had times when you've gone into a bank and they think, well, because you're blind, they must have to talk loudly. And they say, you're £500 overdrawn, Mr. White. And now we don't have to do any of that because we can bank with dignity and confidence in our own homes. Engaging with the wider world on social media. And the thing about the social media aspect is that you can choose to disclose or not. Nobody need know that I'm a blind person unless I choose to tell them. And that can be quite the equalizer. The big change that's happened in the last few years is that accessibility has moved from the exclusive domain of specialized companies now to being seen as the responsibility of mainstream companies. So any device that you pick up, like a smartphone or a computer, will have some accessibility built in. That's a good thing and a bad thing. Sometimes it can take longer for new features that we want to be added, and that compromises nothing about us without us. And the next big challenge was smartphones, particularly when they started coming out with touch screens. And I remember my sinking feeling when I touched the first iPhone, and it just felt to me as a blind person like this blank slab of glass. How was I ever going to work that out? And in fact, Apple came up with a pretty inventive paradigm.
One notification, Teams, messages, Siri suggestions, photos.
In a way, the sighted world had caught up with us. We always wanted books that we could read electronically. Now so do sighted people as well. And it's just one of many examples that demonstrates that accessibility actually benefits everybody. Just little things like grocery shopping. I will never forget the first day that I shopped online for groceries, and I was absolutely staggered by how much choice sighted people had. I had no idea about how many different kinds of loaves of bread or types of milk there were until I was able to shop online. There's never been a better time to be blind. It's been quite the revolution.
So if it's so great, so freeing, why hasn't this been regarded as a totally beneficial experience by everyone? Well, partly because we're not all as technologically adept as Jonathan, and partly because businesses and other organisations have seen digital developments as a way of saving money by dispensing with the human beings who used to be able to help us by that old-fashioned habit of talking to us. Roshni Hafiz is not a Luddite. Like many blind people, she uses technology at work as a VAT officer with HMRC and in her day-to-day life, but admits she struggles with the unremitting pace of change.
I think the difficulty for me and a lot of people of my generation is that we kind of sit right in the middle of the technological revolution that has changed the landscape for visually impaired people. So I grew up learning Braille. I learned touch type. I was comfortable in those mediums. And then technology came along, and there's no denying that the innovation of screen readers and voice-activated technology has changed our community, undeniably for the better. But it came at a time when myself and people like me had already developed our ways and means of being in the world and interacting with the world and getting things done, that the leap almost felt too big. And many of us have caught up, but I think there are also many of us that do just enough to get by in that world and are definitely not as up to speed as our peers in their teens, 20s and 30s. But I feel very torn about it. I feel very torn between the dichotomy of how the world has opened up with technology, but how vulnerable we are to it. It only takes, for example, an application at work to stop working, or for the voice activation on your phone to stop working. And as a totally blind person, you have no idea what's going on. So that empowerment and vulnerability makes me feel very torn between the possibilities in the world and maybe some of the coping and survival skills that we've lost. So being able to think on your feet and even being able to ask for help is something I think that we've lost. We're not performing to our maximum, and we're also denying our employers, our educators, etc., the need or the obligation to do what they have to by giving us the technology and the reasonable adjustments we need to work equally.
This one, it's a tooth, and at the back of it, mm-hmm. there are the roots, gently.
I shall try to be gentle.
You will be gentle.
Oh, it's very pleasing to the hand, yes. to the fingers, and it's got a lot of natural weight.
You feel that at the bottom, where that hand is...
Yeah. Mike Lambert is a thoughtful, bookish man with wide interests and with a love of historical objects and artefacts. He has a lifetime working in further education behind him.
I lost my job because of technology. A new record system was introduced to our department, which was inaccessible. And then it came to the point where things were getting tighter and tighter in education. There would be like annual redundancy rounds. And I was interviewed with questions about a system that I couldn't use. Computers have become so wound into everyday services and things that we need to do. And more thought has been given to how these things can streamline our activities and to lose jobs for people who were previously performing those activities. The emphasis hasn't been on keeping things accessible. That's been forgotten about. So banking, I banked for myself most of my life, and for me, what worked was going into a branch, speaking to a cashier who I might know, and then we got to ATMs, and now things have gone online. I just found it difficult to put my trust in those kind of transactions, and I found it difficult to do the online side of it. So, I mean, as things stand at the moment, I don't do banking anymore. You know, I have a bank account, which Vivian gets money out of. You know, I just get given money.
Don't you feel very disabled by that?
Yes, I do. I feel ashamed, in a way, of the situation because I'm dependent in a way that I wasn't. You know, I feel like, well, if I really tried, perhaps I could do it. Probably I could, but there's so many things happening. And well, in my experience, it's very hard to just simply find out if a thing is accessible or not. So I've got to a position where I'm not asked. I'm going to imagine people listening to this and thinking, well, he's just a miserable old git, isn't he?
That was the next question.
So where are we heading, and what do we need to do about it to help people like Roshni and Mike?
We aren't going to stop the tide of touchscreens.
we aren't going to stop the tide of digital becoming more and more embedded into our daily lives.
Blind data protection and privacy lawyer Matt Johnson.
The way that we have to think about that is firstly through law. In the same way that we needed laws for internet security for banking in the 80s and 90s, we need laws for accessibility, right? One keeps customers safe. The other allows us to maintain our parity. The second is possibly, and I hope that this will happen, with respect to AI. Our ability to communicate in natural language with a system that responds in natural language and has access to all of the peripherals, data, and inputs that the rest of the sighted world does means that we might be able to sort of say to a text box, set me up an appointment with this person next week at a time that's mutually convenient. We then don't have to look at calendars for that. We might be able to say, figure out how long this needs to be put in the oven for, and I'll tell you when it's in the oven and stop the oven when it's done. We might be able to have those radical abilities to communicate with AI as an intermediary.
So are you saying all we might have to do as blind people is talk to the damn thing?
On that level, yes. But what we need for that to happen is, one, a legal framework, because let's not forget AI can be just as inaccessible. The second thing that we should be advocating for is open standard computing, which is a bit more of a complicated topic. But the idea here is that we need to make sure that your Google, your Apple, your social media, and your microwave can all talk to each other in the same language. And that's far from the case at the moment.
Is it going to happen?
I'm not an optimist anymore. I think big tech has accrued far too much power. They can run roughshod over most regulatory and legal regimes that stand in their way. And most people, because they don't have to contend with disability or other sort of minority viewpoints, would be content to let them.
Well, while we hold our breath, waiting for the governments of the world to come up with the kind of legislation that Matt Johnson is describing, the boffins compete to compensate for the lack of sight with fancy bits of tech. But what about those miracle cures to restore sight itself, or indeed to prevent the loss of it in the first place? InTouch has always made rather a thing about living and coping with blindness, rather than getting rid of it altogether. But let's get real. The vast majority of visually impaired people, especially those losing their sight in later life, would give anything to bring to a halt or ideally reverse the process of sight loss. So surely all of this new technology may have a hand in that? Well, it seems not quite yet, to be honest. But we are progressing. I've been to see Pete Thomas, who's the Executive Director of Digital Development at the prestigious Moorfields Eye Hospital in London. Given the task we'd set ourselves of looking into the future, I invited him to look even further ahead, say 50 years.
On that kind of timescale, you're looking at a situation where you probably have almost what's called artificial general intelligence. That's an artificial intelligence that's as good as a human. You know, people used to think that was 50 years away, but latest estimates are from the AI research community is it's possibly as little as 5 or 6 years away. When you've got that, you could imagine a pathway where a patient has a device at home that scans the back of their eye and that can immediately make the diagnosis from home. Let's suppose they have a cataract or they have macular degeneration. Given what we're seeing at the moment with advances in robotics, I think it's very likely that they could have some kind of automated treatment. Their cataract surgery would be performed, possibly not by a human, but by a robot that uses AI to do the surgery, does it all autonomously, and maybe you have one or two humans, you know, in the loop somewhere who are able to keep an eye on everything. But in 50 years' time, they might be outperforming us on all areas. We don't quite know where it's going to go from here.
It's intriguing because one of the things that we are usually very careful about on InTouch is, you know, making these broad claims and over-exciting people with things that may... But we've deliberately let ourselves off the leash for this programme. So if you're right about this, a programme like InTouch could be done for, really.
Well, I mean, one of the benefits if we did get a super intelligence would be that we can imagine many conditions that are not currently treatable could potentially become treatable. But on a 50-year timescale, if we've got, you know, some super intelligences helping us, then, yeah, you can imagine anything would be possible on that timescale.
I won't hold my breath. Thank you very much. Someone who will hopefully be around to see such developments is Sasha McBride. Remember her? We met her earlier in the programme.
I play clarinet, jazz clarinet to be specific. I love jazz. I love playing it because of the swing and just the way it feels.
Chariot? Kunye. Touch gloves.
I love doing taekwondo. I love sparring with my brother. I'm hoping to go for black belt maybe in October.
Along with being an impressive all-rounder, Sasha has just emerged from taking 12 GCSEs. Yes, I did say 12. A bit of a high flyer then, who despite a complex cocktail of eye conditions, wants to study medicine. So what does she expect our technological future to look like, and how could it benefit her future ambitions?
I do really hope that the development of technology will push forward adaptations and make it easier for visually impaired people to function in their day-to-day lives, say in my future job. I'd hope I can sort of be told, okay, there's a person to the right of you who needs so-and-so. They have a rash on the side of their face. This could be so-and-so. And just tell me this is what they look like, this is how they're acting. For me as a doctor, if I were to be, hopefully to be a doctor, I think that would be one of the most interesting things to look at and benefit from.
Well, you're almost looking at a sight replacement machine, aren't you?
Possibly. I know throughout my life I will have to rely on equipment, my computer, distance camera, that type of technology that will develop, hopefully, I will have to rely on. Without it, I think I'd struggle a lot more. And it's weird to say that because I never would have thought how much I would have relied on technology.
At this point, we thought perhaps we ought to take Sasha to meet someone who really knows a thing or two about overachieving when you've got dodgy eyes.
Well, welcome, Sasha, to Westminster Hall. This is the heart of the Palace of Westminster, and rumour has it that Henry VIII used to play a form of tennis in here, and they know that because when they were renovating the roof, they found these odd balls up there from 600 years ago. So, Sasha, never mind about the Palace of Westminster. What about you? Tell me a bit about you.
So I'm 16 years old and I have OCA type 1, or cutaneous albinism, big word.
Certainly is.
And basically it means I have a bunch of visual conditions. Like I have photophobia, which makes the world very bright for me, kind of like a disco ball. I also have a lack of depth perception as well, so anything 3D kind of looks flat to me, so escalators are absolutely horrible to go on.
They are for anyone with any kind of eye condition.
I'm intending to go on to do A-levels, triple science, and maybe an AS in maths, hopefully.
It sounds to me as though you're academically very able, so you're going to do well on that front, aren't you?
I hope so.
Oh, no, confidence.
I mean, in the future, I'd love to become a doctor or go into any type of medicine, because I just really want to find a way to help people.
And I'm the last person to say you can't do what your ambition tells you you can do. The real challenge, presumably, will be how do you get into that and how do you succeed if you've got the kind of challenges that you outlined to me at the beginning. You need really good advice on this, don't you? And then to persuade medical schools that you can do it. What William Blake in his poem London called mind-forged manacles, yeah. i.e. the way other people see things. But you'll have to feel your way, not quite literally, feel your way into what would work. So try and make sure right from the start you're clear what it is you want to do and how you're going to persuade people to help you do it. So go well, Sasha. Really, really good to meet you.
Thank you. Lovely to meet you too, sir.
It would be easy to say that every generation is tripped up by its grandchildren's technology, and that Sasha and her visually impaired peers will be fine. True, but in this case, not much consolation to the blind people who thought they'd figured out how to adapt to the world, only to discover as they grew older that they'd have to start looking for new solutions all over again.
50-50 Vision was presented by Peter White and produced in Salford by Beth Hemmings. On Your Farm is coming up after a look ahead to tomorrow morning.
On BBC Radio 4.
I'm Dave.
I'm Tours. this is our
daughter Nora.
You're telling us. She's seven and an absolute joy.
Documenting the round-the-clock care of Nora, a child with complex disabilities.
She's visually impaired and non-mobile and non-verbal. And when you know her...
When you really know Nora, you can read her cues.
Complex, a new three-part series.
The gulf between what you can get support for and what's actually needed is vast.
On Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, starts tomorrow morning at 11.
Back to this morning on the Sunday programme at 10 past 7 with William Crawley. After rioting in some parts of the country this summer, they'll be hearing from schools preparing to welcome back and reassure pupils coming back after the holidays. And the broadcaster Terry Christian talks about the Irish Catholic background that formed and moulded Oasis. Before that, on Radio 4, On Your Farm, Rebecca Rooney has been following the harvest in the Cotswolds.
Copy, Simon. How's it going?
All right, not too bad at all.
What's it looking like in that far corner? Is it coming off okay?
Yeah, should be all right.
Good, I'll let you crack on. I think it's an iconic site. I love harvest. It's something that is so British. It's so home for me because I've been brought up on a family farm and lucky enough to call this a job.
So that sound is a mighty combine harvester that's setting to work to harvest a field of oilseed rape. Gone are the bright yellow flowers of earlier in the year. Now the crop's looking a bit grey yellow. I'm with Charlie Beldam from Cotswold Gold, farmer who farms this oilseed rape. How's the harvest looking this year?
Well, we started finally. We're not going to lie and pretend it's going to be the best crop we've ever seen. I think we'll all be quite pleased to cut it, get it off the field and start again. As you say, these fields used to be that lovely bright yellow. They've now gone to a very kind of stickly looking brown plant, which is really, really brittle. And if we go over and actually see some of it, which we'll go over now and have a look, you'll see that it's a really brittle pod. And if I take some out and then crunch it up, you'll see the little black seeds that suddenly come out.
You can hear how brittle it is, and then when you crushed those seed pods, they look like mustard seeds.
Yeah, I mean, it's a brassica. It's the same family, and they're small little black seeds, but there is around 44 to 46% oil within every seed. We will literally squeeze this. If we put this on paper and just squeezed it, you'd see a lovely yellow inside, which gives us an amazing gold colour oil. And something that, you know, really, field to bottle, we're talking about metres rather than miles. And I love that about what we do here on the farm, because I think we're using everything and it's a great circular system and something that I'm very proud to do.
The second combine is starting just behind us. What do you do with the leftover bits on them?
So normally, rapeseed, we smash the plant up and put it back onto the soil, and then that gets cultivated. Because of how wet it has been, there is not as much wheat or barley and straw in the country. And so we've actually had farmers locally who've turned around and said, we really need help. We need more straw for our cattle for bedding down. And they're going to come in tonight and they'll bale all of this. And that's always a toss-up between the value of it versus the green manure, the organic matter of it breaking down in the soil. So it's not something we normally do, but this winter's been an odd year.
And as the combine moves further down the field, you've talked about how this year's harvest has not been easy because of the weather, but oilseed rape is notoriously tricky in other ways too. There's like pests like flea beetle. What kind of year has it been from a pest point of view?
Awful, if I'm going to be frank with it. Everybody has found rapeseed harder to grow. Now, may that be that neonicotinoids were banned, but we don't use them anyway. The flea beetle have caused a huge amount of issue. They can come in and devastate a field. We've had very, very dry time in
September, which is when we were actually wanting the seeds to grow, and that hasn't helped. It's helped the flea beetle, not us. We should have had a lot more rape this year, but we've actually written a lot off. We are finding it difficult, and I think there's a lot of farmers around here who are actually coming out of rapeseed.
So you're down on yield, and what about the quality?
The quality for what we've cut so far, it's a lovely black seed. Rapeseed is no different to an olive oil, to a wine. It's terroir. It's the variety, it's the soil, it's the sea level, and there are so many. I think there's over 90 different varieties of rapeseed in the UK alone.
Perhaps we could go and see what happens to all these oilseed rape seeds.
We can indeed. Let's go and have a look.
You produce oil from the oilseed rape, but as an arable farmer, there are other advantages to growing oilseed rape.
Yeah, it's all about being a sustainable rotation. Rapeseed actually is a really good crop for the soil. It's got a really deep tapping root that helps with soil erosion prevention and also drainage, and it breaks up the soil for brilliant for the following crop. We would normally have 50% of the farm as milling wheat, and then the other 50% split between rape, linseed and beans.
So out of your overall farm of about 3,000 acres, how many acres are oilseed and how many are wheat?
We'd ideally like to have this year 1,000 acres of rapeseed, but it hasn't happened that way. So we are about 600 acres of rapeseed this year, and that is due to flea beetle, so yeah, 40% actually down. But that is the weather, and also a lot of it was a difficult year to grow because of how dry it was in September, where the migration of flea beetle decided to explode. It comes always once a year, but it depends on the weather and when it comes, and if you've got a big enough, strong enough plant, it can withstand it. If they're small and emerging, then they can strip the whole field overnight.
And what about the use of pesticides to control the flea beetle?
They don't work. We don't do it. We are not organic. We are sustainably grown. We look at our rotation. There are chemicals out there that you could spray, but you can spray them one night and they'll be back the following morning. We have decided that actually if it attacks a field and you're not going to win, you write the field off. Sometimes your first loss is your best loss.
Head back to the farm.
Yeah, we'll head back to the farm now and go and show you how it goes from field to bottle.
So we've taken a little detour on our way back from the field before we go to where the oilseed rape is crushed, and we're back at the main farm with silos full of grain, and this is where you measure all sorts.
Yeah, so every field comes back on a trailer. All the grain that we've just seen being harvested comes back to base, and this is our base. We've got a weighbridge just behind us. Everything goes on that, so we know how much seed comes off every single field, and that allows us to see if we've done a good job through the year, but also what we've got to play with for the rest of the year. Trailer going onto the weighbridge, and you can hear the weighbridge moving. Here we go, this noise. It allows us to record on every single load, so we have weighbridge tickets.
So the field we were looking at earlier on, is that done yet?
Yeah, so that one was Big Didcot, and you can see that has arrived here, where it's now been put into a pit, and then it's been cleaned and gone into a silo. But if we look at this machine here, so we take a sample, and we put it in the machine, and then this is where I get it wrong. So this has got a oil content of 46.1%, so we're really happy with that. That should make some really lovely oil.
Hi, pleased to meet you. And you're Richard Beldam.
Yeah, I am.
And we've just been looking at the whole of the oilseed rape harvest. Quite different to what the farm looked like when you were farming, when you were Charlie's age.
Indeed. We didn't actually grow oilseed rape in the UK at all until the mid-70s. And then it was a bit of a niche crop to start with. And then in the 80s and 90s, it got very popular. It's probably going backwards a bit now.
It's not the easiest crop to grow, is it? Do you sometimes think, oh, why does Charlie persist with this?
Indeed, you're absolutely spot on. It is not easy to grow, and it seems to be getting more difficult to grow. And some of that's climate, some of it's pest damage, some of it is withdrawal of some of the crop protection products we used to use. And you add the whole lot together, it's getting more difficult.
And I suppose it's also to do with the scale of a farm. You're a big arable farm. So if things go wrong, maybe you can take the hit and then maybe other people move out of oilseed rape and then the market is then in your favour. And it's harder for perhaps smaller farmers, do you think, to do what you've done?
Undoubtedly, that is true. We were a small farmer. We started here with 140 acres in 1965. We've been very fortunate. The political situation and the economic situation has allowed us to prosper really quite well. So that's been fine. I think it's going to be much, much more difficult in the future.
I mean, that's quite an understatement because you've done very well, haven't you? I mean, 160 acres to what, 3,000 now?
Well, yes, be careful. We only own about half of it. The other half we run for other people. And that's been very interesting and very rewarding. And I have to say, given us a huge amount of enjoyment, which has been very, very good.
Let's go.
You're listening to On Your Farm, and we're telling the story of Charlie Beldam's farm at Broadway in the Cotswolds. So we've left the harvest where they're gathering in this year's oilseed rape, and this is where you turn it into a product, Charlie.
Yeah, so we've just come down to one of our farm yards, which I have developed. 14 years ago, I was at Cirencester Agriculture College doing a three-year course there, and I did a diversification project on adding value to something on the farm, and I chose rapeseed. We were growing that as part of our rotation, and I wanted to add value to something we grew, and that is where the idea stemmed from. So I came away and I remember very, very clearly being in the kitchen, the farmhouse kitchen, and turning around to Mum and Dad at, I think it was midnight, we come off the combines, and I said, I've been thinking about it, I'm going to give that oil business a go. And 14 years later, we're now standing just outside my factory, which personally I've built everything other than the electrics, and we now have 20 members of staff that are in here producing oil, mayonnaise, dressings, sauces, all off our family farm, and I absolutely love it. I work with some of the top mission restaurants in the country, through to fish and chip shops, farm shops, delis, garden centres, and actually that is what excites me. That's what gets me out of bed, and we've got to where we are today, and we're a really good, strong business. We know we've had to see a recession in 2010 when I started. We've then had the dramas of the last 10 years. We've had COVID, we've had inflation in Ukraine, and actually we've weathered all of them and built the team, if anything. We've got stronger because of it. Ukraine was through us, horrendous what has happened over there, but for rapeseed, they produced 70% of the sunflower oil in the world, and that stopped overnight because they couldn't get it out of Odessa and places like that. And so naturally people were changing away from sunflower oil to be able to get oil in, and that opened up new markets to us that we never saw coming.
Perhaps you can go and have a look at what you're doing
come
here.
Come on in. So all of this used to be an old dairy unit, so we're walking in now to the office, which was an old calf pen. We've got Ross in here.
Hello, Ross.
And these were all converted, so we will go through into the factory now, and we'll get suited and booted, put lovely blue hair nets on, and you'll start to hear the presses in the background as we do that. So, the most fetching clothes wear. There is a hair net.
And put on some overshoes. And
I will
overcoat.
Grab some for you. Oh, hang on, let me open the door for the world. There you go, Will.
Cheers.
Thank
you.
Let's swap around.
In you come.
So, we're now in the factory.
I can smell. Is that the oil seeds that I can smell?
Yeah.
Almost smells like pickled gherkins.
Yeah, well, probably not the way I'd describe it, but yes, there is a different smell in here. We've got 8 presses that are running 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We use a cold pressing method, that lovely golden oil that you can kind of see coming in the pipes above us. We'll produce about 500,000 litres a year. And if we come down here, and I'll show you what we're doing. At the top of the hoppers, feeding into each one is rapeseed. Those little black seeds that we've just seen coming off the farm, they are coming down and they are being squeezed against a plate. And that's where you can see this golden oil starting to drip out the back. So you've got the oil coming out the back, and then out the front we've got this pellet. This green pellet is the leftover of the press. This is cattle feed. So this goes out of the factory every 15 minutes and is supplied to local cattle farmers. It's really high in protein, great for their animal feed, and we work with local farmers to supply it back into the food chain. So it really is a circular system. There's very little waste in here, of less than 1%.
Moving through the curtain and into a slightly quieter part of the factory. What's going on in here?
This is where we actually make the oil into a lot of other different products. On our right here, we've got our mayonnaise section. We can make up to 3.5 tons of mayonnaise a day, and that is a lovely golden colour. It's got a really creamy flavour to it. We built this, knocked through. I remember that day very clearly, and everything you see other than the electrics, myself and Thomas, who is our production manager, have actually produced ourselves. The way that the family work, we have our combine driver, Simon, and also, she's smiling now, this is Simon's stepdaughter.
Hello, hi. What's your name?
Emily.
Emily, and what are you doing here, Emily?
Weighing out honey ready for Lucy's dressing tomorrow.
And do you think you can taste the difference between the oilseed rape that you're producing here and, say, another oil that you might buy in the supermarket?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that was the correct answer. Sorry, with the boss watching you.
It also shows that it's a family affair. It's not just my family from the farm to here. We've got Simon, and actually on the other combine is your nephew. So, his nephew, your cousin. So it really is, it's a massive family affair.
So you don't know when you're going to see them then, if they're harvesting tonight.
No, I bump into them all the time.
You never get away from the family at home. Yeah, and that's what we love about here. So we've got a pallet here being wrapped of Caesar dressing. That's actually being shipped up to London today. I think you've got 9 pallets of that going today that's been produced. So we'll come out here, and we're now out into the dispatch area. And the dispatch area,
we're surrounded by stacks, and one pallet that we just saw being bottled is now being cling filmed, ready to go in the back of the lorry.
We'll just mind this up.
Move out the way of the forklift. And over here, what are you doing, sir?
My name is Thomas. I'm preparing the orders for local Broadway deli. It's a huge order. Many different variation of the oil.
Oh, and I can just see some little glass bottles of.
We've got some 100 ml the garlic oil here. They also asking for chili oil as well. You got the deal here as well.
And that's off to the local deli.
Yeah. I am the delivery driver, but I also the preparing the orders. I helping guys with the production. And
always busy.
Always busy. Never stop.
And do you have a favorite variety of oil?
I think the garlic and smoke, which is I like the most. They are really good with the barbecue.
Thomas has been with us 6 years now. We are, as I say, as good as our team, and I couldn't do it without it. I have an amazing team behind me that I actually love coming to work with, and that is a huge, huge thing. So we're now opening up an area of the factory that is really the engine. We have rapeseed that will come back up against this hopper. The little black seeds will come out and go into this auger.
You can see where it's been fed down, so handfuls of it.
We are crushing around 7-8 tons a day, so we are filling this up weekly.
We've seen the oil seed rape being harvested, Charlie Beldam, here at Broadway in the Cotswolds. We've seen it being pressed, turned into things like mayonnaise. And then this is the end. This is the waste. And we're looking at cartons of spent oil.
Yeah, so interesting use of words on that for waste. I don't see waste as the way waste is meant to be. I try and use everything we possibly can. So the oil we're looking at here, this is not...
These are cans that have come from kitchens.
Yeah, so we supply local pubs, restaurants, fish and chip shops, schools. And our system is we will supply them good oil and we'll take their waste oil back. Here, it's not pretty, but we've got cans that have come back. It's dark. You can see the difference in colour of the oil. So this has come out of a deep fat fryer. We use metal cans so we can wash them and reuse them. And they've got fish and chips still in them. We've got to love chefs, but we find knives, we find saucepans, everything.
Oh, really? All kinds of detritus.
Absolutely everything. We've built this system here ourselves. This is an old oil tank. And in the top...
So we move a bit closer. It's about the size of a home oil tank if you had oil central heating. And then you can see all the black stuff on the top, and inside there is straw that then filters the spent oil.
So it is exactly that. It is an old oil tank that's come out of our house, and we brought it here and we made a hopper in the top, and it's got linseed straw. It's quite sticky around here, but underneath this netting we have got linseed, which is in this straw, and that is, you can also see, I mean, what have we got there? We've got a deep fried sausage, that's lovely. We've got batter, we've got fish and chips that come just out of probably poor maintenance from a restaurant. But
so you're filtering out all the bits and bobs that have got left in the oil, and then what do you do with those? Just
so they,
put
they'll
them
go
in
back
the compost?
On, yeah, they'll go back on the land because you know they'll break down and go onto the field. And then we get a really nice kind of clear, spent, dirty oil. And that is then made into biofuel. So it really is a circular system from start to finish, using everything we possibly can. Our heating here for the winter is actually powered 100% off rapeseed oil, which is oil that has gone through this process. So it really is trying to use as many things as we possibly can that we make here and make sure we're not losing stuff through waste, because waste is... it's a loss through the business. So I think it's really important for what I set up that we make as little impact on the environment as possible, but also make great produce.
Charlie Beldam, thank you very much.
Thank you.
On Your Farm was produced and presented by Rebecca Rooney. Before the news at 7 o'clock, time for a look at the weather. Here's Simon King.
Thank you. Good morning. It's a little bit mixed today. We have got some sunny spells, but also the risk of some heavy and thundery showers. Let's try and put some detail on that, though. In southwest, southeast England, the Midlands and eastern England, it's a pretty cloudy start for the day. And we've already got some heavy downpours moving their way northwards just across parts of Hertfordshire into Cambridgeshire this morning. Those will continue to move a bit further north. And then we're going to see some heavy and thunderous showers moving in, particularly around central southern parts of England, and they will spread their way northward into the Midlands later this morning. We could see some frequent lightning, some very heavy rain and some very gusty winds all associated with these storms. Not everybody will see them, I have to stress. They're going to be quite hit and miss. Towards southwest England and the east of England, perhaps a little bit drier and brighter with some sunshine into the afternoon, but that could in turn set off one or two very isolated thundery downpours. It's very warm and humid. Temperatures will be getting up to 22 to 25 degrees, but 28 or 29 in southeast England. For Wales and northern England, mostly cloudy with some showery rain in northern England. That's clearing away northward. Sunny spells will develop in Wales and northeast England, but in the northwest of England, it will stay largely cloudy with further showers, perhaps thunderstorms spreading in later this afternoon. Highs of 19 to 22. For Northern Ireland, a few bright spells this morning, but mostly cloudy. It should stay dry with highs of 16 to 18. And across Scotland today, a few showers this morning in southern Scotland. Those will clear. Staying pretty cloudy with further heavier showers, possibly thunderstorms in the south later this afternoon. It's going to be drier, though, in northern Scotland with some sunshine and highs of 16 to 21. As for the rest of the week, it's looking pretty mixed, actually. Be further heavy showers and thunderstorms on Monday.
On BBC iPlayer.
We are not in control of this situation.
We know that these shootings are very upsetting for the community.
It's a gathering storm, and I'm worried about anyone who's at the centre of it.
There will be consequences.
And this culture or code of not grassing, we are way beyond that now.
They're all turning on each other. This ends before it begins.
Revenge runs in the family. I go down, you go down.
Blood for blood.
Put them down.
We've been in danger before.
But this is different, Rory. Look at me. This is different.
Sherwood, Series 2.
It's on a knife edge out there.
Continues tonight on BBC iPlayer.
And later today, the writer of Sherwood, James Graham, is the subject in the first of a new series of Profile. That's After the Archers at 12:15 on 92 to 95 FM on BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker. This is BBC Radio 4.
BBC News at 7 o'clock on Sunday, the 1st of September. Good morning, this is Tom Sanders. The bodies of six hostages held by Hamas in Gaza have been recovered by Israeli troops. Elections are taking place in eastern Germany that could see a strong showing for the far-right AfD. The SNP leader John Swinney is to tell his party it will need to work harder and smarter to deliver for Scotland. Israel's military has recovered the bodies of six hostages from Gaza. They were found in an underground tunnel in Rafah. They were among more than 250 hostages taken during the 7th of October attacks. A mass polio vaccination campaign is also getting underway in Gaza. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, John Donison, reports.
Both Israel and Hamas have agreed to pause fighting in central Gaza between 6 o'clock in the morning and 3 in the afternoon local time. The first pause will last 3 days, with the United Nations saying it could be extended for a fourth day if needed. The vaccination campaign will then move to other parts of the Gaza Strip. UNICEF says it's aiming to vaccinate 640,000 children and babies in total. The first case of the highly infectious disease, which causes paralysis, was confirmed in a 10-month-old baby last week. Meanwhile, the Israeli military has confirmed the bodies of six hostages being held by Hamas have been discovered in Gaza. It says they were found in a tunnel in Rafah. It's named the dead hostages as Israelis Alexander Lobanov, Almog Sarusi, Eden Yerushalmi, Ori Danino, Carmel Gatt and Hirsch Goldberg Polin, who was also an American citizen.
Voting has just started in two elections in eastern Germany, where the far-right AfD party is expected to perform strongly. It's anti-immigration, wants to replace the euro with the Deutschmark, and opposes the national government's approach to the war in Ukraine and climate change. One of the polls is taking place in Thuringia. Our correspondent Jessica Parker is in the state capital, Erfurt.
These are regional, not national elections. Regardless, the result could be seismic. Polls suggest that the far-right Alternative for Deutschland is leading in Thuringia and running a close second in Saxony. But because the AfD is viewed by many as extremist, an absence of willing coalition partners is likely to keep it from power. In Thuringia, the party is headed by a highly controversial figure, Bjorn Höcke. He's a talisman of the AfD's hard right and was fined twice this year for knowingly using a Nazi slogan, which he denied. Predictions also suggest the vote could be a major repudiation of the three parties governing Germany under Chancellor Olaf Scholz.
Scotland's First Minister John Swinney will promise to focus on what he'll call the people's priorities when he addresses the SNP conference in Edinburgh this afternoon. The party is trying to find a strategy for recovery after heavy losses in the general election 2 months ago. Our political correspondent Andrew Kerr is at the conference.
John Swinney will say he set his focus on the priorities of the people of Scotland. That's ending child poverty, reaching net zero, delivering strong public services and boosting growth. Seeking a less polarised national debate, the leader will also say the SNP's independence campaign will be deeply intertwined with those priorities and people's everyday concerns. He'll also attack the Labour government, saying in this era of Westminster cuts, the party's going to have to work harder and smarter to deliver.
An investigation has started after the bodies of three children and a man were found at a house in Surrey. The police were called to the property in Staines-upon-Thames yesterday afternoon. They say they're working to establish exactly what happened, but at this stage are not looking for anyone else. The police complaints watchdog has been informed because of previous contact between officers and those who died. Researchers are recruiting children to take part in a project studying the long-term impact of lockdowns on the talking and thinking skills of babies born during the COVID pandemic. Academics from six UK universities hope to identify what support they may need during their education, as Vanessa Clark explains.
The Bicycle Study, which stands for Born in COVID Year Core Lockdown Effects, is looking at what impact the strictest lockdowns, when everyone was told to stay at home, had on the development of the youngest members of society. Initial research has found that reduced interactions with members of their extended family and the loss of access to services such as health visitors has affected the speech of some children. The number on the waiting list for a speech and language therapy appointment in England is now 75,000, up from 65,000 2 years ago. Schools and preschools are seeing a rising number of children with special educational needs and disabilities, more attendance issues, and fewer children entering reception classes already toilet trained. The government says it will be focusing on high quality early education to give every child the best start in life.
Airports across Europe, which had scrapped 100 milliliter limits for liquids in hand luggage, have been told they must put the restrictions back in place from today. The European Commission says the reintroduction is a temporary measure to address a technical issue with new equipment. The UK took a similar step earlier this summer. The Department for Transport said it was working with manufacturers and airports to lift the restrictions when possible. In tennis, the British player Dan Evans has been knocked out of the US Open. He lost his third-round match against Alex de Minaur in four sets. The only Briton left in either of the singles competitions is Jack Draper. He faces Tomáš Machač of the Czech Republic in the last 16. The organisers of the Paralympics in Paris have postponed the triathlon events that were due to take place in the River Seine because of concerns about the water quality. The deterioration is being blamed on 2 days of heavy rain. Officials hope to run the event tomorrow. As Paul Serres reports, there's still plenty of competition to look out for.
There are 64 gold medal events at the Paris Games today. The British pair of Neil and Laura Fackey will be hoping to repeat their exploits from 3 years ago in Tokyo, where the married couple won gold within 16 minutes of each other. Laura in the individual pursuit B and Neil in the men's time trial B, with pilot Matt Rotherham. Lauren Rolls will be hoping for a third Paralympics title, going in the mixed double sculls in the para-rowing with partner Greg Stevenson. At the Stade de France, the world record holder Sabrina Fortune goes in the F20 shot put, and the wheelchair sprinter Hannah Cockcroft will race for her fourth consecutive T34 100-metre title.
That's the news. Now time for a look at the Sunday papers. The Sunday Times leads on a warning from the Education Secretary that parents are significantly denting their children's future earning potential by letting them skip school. Bridget Phillipson is quoted as saying she will act decisively to tackle what she called an absence epidemic. The paper highlights government analysis that suggests every day missed from the classroom costs children hundreds of pounds in wages over their lifetime. The Sunday Telegraph says teachers' unions have told Ms. Phillipson to scrap exams on times tables as part of a review of the curriculum in England. It reports that ministers are also being asked to strip back tests on grammar to curb pupil anxiety. A union source questions whether primary school children really need to know about modal verbs and fronted adverbials. But the former Conservative Education Minister Nick Gibb says the changes would be a retrograde step. A government spokesperson says its review aims to strengthen core skills in reading, writing and maths. The Observer's front page focuses on a study indicating that most people expect to go private for routine health treatments because they believe that they won't be able to get them quickly enough on the NHS. The findings are based on extensive focus group analysis conducted by Loughborough University on behalf of the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, which funds research into social policy. Harry asks former aides to help plot his return from exile is the Mail on Sunday's headline. It says the Duke of Sussex is consulting people from his old life on how to mastermind a return from the US. The article said representatives for Prince Harry didn't respond to its request for comment. The Sunday Mirror says a new Netflix documentary about the serial killer nurse Lucy Letby will feature experts who've questioned her conviction. The paper says it will mean fresh agony for the families of the 14 babies she murdered or tried to kill. The article says Netflix and the production company ITN have not commented. Pubs warn of smoking ban violence is the headline on the front of the Sunday Express. It says landlords fear the government's proposed ban on outdoor smoking could turn beer gardens and terraces into flashpoints. The former Tory party chairman Richard Holden tells the Express the plan would put bar staff in the firing line of customers. Sir Keir Starmer says he's making the decision to reduce the burden on the NHS. Several papers pick up on the online scramble to buy tickets for the Oasis comeback tour. The Daily Star Sunday says millions of fans were left crying their hearts out in what it called a shambles supernova. Wonder Wales is the headline in The Sun on Sunday. It says there was fury from some fans who waited more than 10 hours to buy tickets, only for the booking website to time them out. The paper's editorial takes aim at people reselling tickets at inflated prices. And that's our look at the Sunday papers.
That was Tom Sanders. This is BBC Radio 4. Good morning. In an hour's time, there's music from the new Irish Youth Choir in Sunday Worship from Northern Ireland. First, though, it's Sunday with William Crawley.
Thanks very much. Good morning. And we will, of course, bring you more on that breaking news story this morning that the bodies of six hostages taken on October the 7th have now been found in a tunnel in southern Gaza.
The six hostages are Alexander Lobanov, Almog Sarusi, Eden Yerushalmi, Ori Danino, Carmel Gat and Hirsch Goldberg Polin, who was an Israeli-American citizen.
Our correspondent John Donison there, he'll be joining us live this morning from Jerusalem. Also coming up, an emergency vaccine rollout is about to begin in Gaza, within the next few minutes, in fact, to try to prevent the spread of polio amongst Palestinian children. We'll also eavesdrop on a Bible study with one of the world's most acclaimed novelists, Marilyn Robinson.
Our literature proceeds from the Bible in a very great degree. It really becomes serious when the printed Bible becomes widely available.
And even the Sunday programme, yes, the Sunday programme, is talking about the Gallagher brothers. Baby, I just don't believe, maybe you're the same as me. We see things I'll never see. You and I don't live forever. We will go in search of the Catholic roots of the Oasis swagger. Your emails to sunday@bbc.co.uk. We're on social media at @BBCR4Sunday. As schools return in various parts of the country, there will be an additional challenge this year in the wake of last month's riots. In some cases, we saw school-aged young people taking part in that violence, and their presence in schools this week may understandably be a cause of anxiety for other pupils from a minority ethnic or immigrant background. Take Bina, for example, a 15-year-old from Toxteth in Liverpool, about to embark on her GCSEs. She saw some of the violence herself erupting in her local area.
Apparently there was a mosque around my house and I didn't know. I heard a lot of fireworks and police and all that. And then I look out of my window and I just see people running. And they just like blocked the, like they used the bins to block the road and there's like things on fire and there's like a lot of police just standing there and people are running, shouting. And it was very scary. I've never really experienced that or ever like seen it before. So seeing it for the first time was kind of scary and I was kind of confused like why it's happening.
Bina, as far as we can tell, you had a sense that there were some people from your school who may have been caught up in some of that violence. Is that right?
If, like, I'm not 100% sure, but like there's some kids in my school that I feel like they would have, you know, take part in that case.
How do you deal with that in your mind as you're going back to school thinking one of these other pupils around me or students around me might have been one of those out there with the fireworks or engaging in the rioting?
Sometimes, I mean, it used to make me feel scared and worried, but when I think about it, it won't affect anything in my school because teachers in my school, they don't tolerate any of that.
You're very strong. I can tell that. I just wonder about other kids, other young people, younger than you as well, for example, who may not have that kind of intellectual focus that you clearly have, Bina, or that sense of personal strength. They may be carrying that fear with them in the school.
Well, it's all about confidence. I mean, if I didn't went through all that and faced racism and experienced it, I don't think today I would be able to stand up for myself or speak up for myself. My mother helped me, and it was very hard because I was very shy and I wasn't outspoken like I am now.
Do you think schools are the right place to have an open conversation about all of these issues with young people?
Yes, I think it's important, so people have more knowledge of it and understand it better and know that to say comments like that is not okay and it will never be acceptable.
Our thanks to Bina. And Glyn Potts is with us, head teacher of St John Henry Newman Roman Catholic College in Oldham in Greater Manchester. Good morning, Glyn.
Good morning.
Are you concerned about those kinds of anxieties in this year's returning class?
I think we all should be. I think we all saw what happened over the summer, and we can sense that anxiety that may exist in our community. And we've got to do more to address that. Schools should be places of safety and welcome. And there is a question mark for some of our community, both in terms of the children and the staff. And we have a duty to answer that question to make sure they feel the welcome of return.
What kind of preparations have you put in place?
Well, our pastoral team have been liaising with the local Youth Justice Service and the fabulous team in Oldham who do the youth work to make sure none of our young people are involved in there. Our attendance team will be working with individual families to remove concerns over anxiety of returning to school, including those young people who may have been involved in some of the disturbances. Because, you know, actually, our job is to educate, not necessarily to discipline, and we've got to choose the right thing. And finally, our mental health team will be providing some support to individual students, but also some whole school assemblies on it. And on our first day back as a Catholic school, we will hold a Mass where we will celebrate the fact we're all made in the image of God. And our PSHE lessons this week will be central to removing any of the anxiety around what happened over the summer and showing people about the damage of it.
We've been in touch with the Department for Education. They've provided us with information that they say they've shared with schools, including details about the website Educate Against Hate. They say they've been reviewing the curriculum to add lessons about tackling fake news and the like. Have you found those resources helpful?
I think they're fairly generic. I found a statement by Sir Hamid Patel very, very helpful. I felt it captured the mood of educators very well. But equally, each individual school is a community in its own right, and they will tackle those issues in an appropriate way, which is right and for their community in which they serve. There's 1,500 young people in my school, 33% of them are British Muslim, and I have a large number of international new arrivals. The context of my school and why I have to address it will be different to another school, and I think it's important that we do it in the right way and in a sensitive way.
Two aspects to your school there, very interesting, the diversity you've just mentioned and also the Catholic ethos. How are you bringing them together? How is your Catholic ethos working to help you protect and advance the interests of these kids in these difficult circumstances?
Well, it's my belief that Catholic schools have had a long history of inclusion and a duty to ensure that all, particularly those of differing or no religion, are exposed to and feel evidence of welcome. And that's a real strong tenet in the work that we do. And our patron talks about heart speaking to heart. And that's exactly what we will be doing in this first few days of the new term, making sure that those people who do not necessarily believe themselves to be Catholic or who do not have a faith at all are really clear that their place at my school, their place at our community, is as valid as anybody else's, and that their contributions to our society and what we stand for in British values and Catholic values are absolutely aligned with their view of what a safe and tolerant society should be.
Glyn Potts, many thanks. Sex and Islam, not the kind of words you typically see together, are they? At least not when it comes to discussions about pleasure or physical intimacy. We know that a lack of understanding about sex can lead to a fear of intimacy or to unbalanced sexual roles, and in extreme cases it can lead to abuse within relationships. Step Forward, a movement that is trying to demystify sexual education for Muslims, driven largely by women and social media who have chosen to speak openly about sex, though perhaps predictably they've also faced a backlash from some more conservative sections of their community. Geeta Penzi meets one of those pioneering women, Mutia Budruddin in this week's Heart and Soul from the BBC World Service.
Sex is very important. It would be, for most of us, the only opportunity that we do get. So, yeah, if you're going to be shackling yourself, for want of a better word, to a person to say, you're going to be my one sexual partner for the rest of my life, which is not always the case, alhamdulillah, or, you know, as the case might be. No, because, I mean, yeah, let's be real. This is a safe space.
This is Mutia Badruddin, a 40-something Nigerian mother of three and experienced doctor. Dressed in a black niqab with a shawl over the top and a silver pleated skirt. I'll be honest, she's not what I imagined a sex educator might look like. But Mutia runs workshops and lectures on sexual and reproductive health awareness. Right now, she's studying creative writing, as well as building her new social enterprise working on sex education. So we're coming into, is this one of your lecture rooms?
It's actually the lecture theatre in the Enterprise Centre. So I have over 18 years of experience in obstetrics and gynaecology, mostly in Nigeria and in Saudi Arabia. And one thing that became very obvious to me very quickly was the fact that women generally, but Muslim women in particular, do not know enough about their body. And that is being me being generous. They do not know anything about their bodies.
Mutia has delivered these workshops in different parts of the world, with her most recent here, where she's currently studying.
Half of the time I'm dealing with just like issues that maybe not totally prevented, but would have been mitigated by just access to proper information and support.
To give me a sense of what Mutia does, she let me listen in on one of her workshops.
Do we understand what I just said? Or because I see some people looking at me like, okay, isn't that what he's supposed to be doing? No, that's not what he's supposed to be doing. That's not what he's supposed to be doing. And that's my point. The basic knowledge is the next thing you want to talk about. Do you know your body?
I asked Mutia how she decides what to talk about in the workshops.
Oh, literally anything. And as long as it is related to sexual and reproductive health, there is no topic that is out of bounds.
Do you think there are specific barriers for Muslim women?
Oh, definitely there are specific barriers for Muslim women. There's the very idea that you're even talking about it in the first instance is a barrier. Because people look at you sideways. I've had that judgment, you know, where people are like, but why are you talking about that? That's supposed to be behind closed doors. And I'm like, no, this is health. We are talking about health here. This is not something to be ashamed about. I know that there's been a veil of shame around our societies when it comes to issues of sexuality, but this is, you're literally going towards what is halal for you. This is the only way that it is halal for you, which is why I brought it up earlier. Then you should have no shame around having serious conversations. And again, because it's something that's going to affect all of your lives.
Mutia's faith is in no way lightly held. As niqabi, she wears a full face veil. And it was clear to me as we walked towards each other at the station that she stands out. I wanted to ask how she addresses that gap between her students' faith and what most people understand as the science of sex education.
Like I said, if you're not interested in what I'm talking about, what I'm trying to do, that's all well and good. Just, you know, I'm here for the people who are.
And the workshops that you've run in Nigeria, as well as here in the UK, are there differences in knowledge of the Muslim women that you've met?
Interestingly, no. I'm flabbergasted. When I started this project, it was just a month before I left Nigeria, I had the idea that, you know, it was something that was needed in Nigeria and it was something that was needed in Saudi Arabia and really all of the Arab countries where I'd been for so long. But coming to the UK, I thought you guys have a fantastic network of just like sexual reproductive health. I didn't need to do anything. And then I started talking to Muslim women here and I found out that, oh my God, there is no difference. We are all the same.
Talking to Mutia is fascinating. She's clearly a powerhouse and inspired by so many aspects of her life. But I wanted to know more about this woman who wears the niqab and how she ended up teaching sex education to other Muslim women.
There was a lot of pushback from my medical school. The people who were most virulent in the way they reacted to me and my presenting, so obviously Muslim,
were the surgeons. Anyway, so the idea of working with only women was fascinating to me. So I think that's why I fell into obstetrics and gynecology. There's history there, there's context there, all of that. And I try not to let that hold me back. I just do what I want to do anyways. Understanding that, yes, there are limitations that come with how I choose to present. Not that the niqab limits me. It's usually people's reaction to the niqab, people's perception of the niqab, people's thoughts of what should be allowed to a woman in a cup that limits me. But, you know, it's a choice I keep making every day.
Mutia Budruddin there, and you can hear that fascinating fuller investigation, The Muslim Sex Educators, on BBC Science. Ticket sales for the Oasis reunion tour opened yesterday morning, and the scramble for tickets began to look like a biblical exodus as millions tried to rush through the digital waters to a supersonic promised land. And I promise that is the end of the theological puns. Well, you may look in vain for religious ideas in the 75 million records Oasis have sold, but with songs like Masterplan and Live Forever, there is clearly a spiritual backdrop worth noticing in the Gallagher brothers and their Irish Catholic roots in Manchester. The writer and broadcaster Terry Christian co-authored the book Brothers from Childhood to Oasis, The Real Story, with Noel and Liam's older brother, Paul Gallagher. He also famously presented The Word on Channel 4, which was the venue for Oasis's first TV appearance. He joins us now. Welcome, Terry.
Yes, welcome. I didn't just present it. I had to argue for 8 weeks to get them on.
Yeah, and this was before they actually released a single.
Yeah, so this was like the middle of March 1994. But it's because the guy who was our music booker at the time on The Word had turned down the Cranberries. And I didn't let him forget that. So he didn't want to make that mistake again. Because I have a terrible habit of telling people, I told you so.
Well, if that doesn't get you a couple of tickets to the reunion tour, Terry, I don't know what will. Irish Catholic Mancunian, put those together for us, would you, in the story of the Gallagher brothers?
Well, I mean, it's quite a common thing, you know. I think Manchester must be, what, 35% Catholic at least, you know, growing up in those inner city areas. You know, I grew up in Old Trafford. So again, you know, we were a bit closer to the city centre than Burnage, but then they started out in the Longside area. These were all inner city areas where basically it tended to be immigrants. So obviously, again, it's one of those unspoken things. So although, you know, Catholicism just means you're part of a community, really. You know that you've got certain weird things in common, and it's only when you step outside Catholicism or talk to each other, they go, this is weird. Christianity meets a bit of witchcraft, meets some superstition, meets a few hundred years' worth of oppression, and that's Irish Catholicism. and obviously, with Paul, one of the first things I did, you know, to get to know him when we were doing the book, Brothers from Childhood to Oasis, which is really about their upbringing, about the dad, about their Irish roots, and the mum, because the mother was one of 11, you know, six girls. They all slept in the one bed. The dad used to go over to work in England every year, and he just disappeared and didn't come back one year. So the mother couldn't keep 11 kids. So some of the girls were sent away to live with the nuns in Ballyhadrina. You know, this is, they grew up in Mayo. This is the next county along in Roscommon. And obviously, the Catholic Church informed everything. So with Paul, you know, one of his happy memories of the summer holidays would be going over to County Meath first, where the Gallaghers lived, you know, with Tommy. And I am, you know, even the mum pronounces it properly. The only people who don't pronounce the name Gallagher properly are Noel and Liam. Gallagher and everybody else now, it seems.
Listen, you've made them sound like a Colm Tobin novel, but actually, if you want to find a parable in the story of these two guys, it's all there. I mean, there are biblical dimensions to this. Prodigal sons or brothers, sibling rivalry. You've got the creation of Oasis, the fall, and now the big reunion, the return. It's all there, Terry, if you want to find it.
Well, it was the whole original band were all Irish. Because they were Liam's mates, you know, so Bowen Ed, Paul Arthurs, I think he's from County, you know, his parents were from Foxford in County Mayo. And so they were there. And then when they'd go over to Ireland every summer as kids, their Uncle Paddy used to always bring them for a day out in Knock. And I remember I went there with Paul Gallagher to have a look around. It was like, I suppose, an Aldi version of Lourdes. And one of those strange things again, you know, even with the mum, she grew up with the nuns, then she had a job when she was a youngster looking after five young priests. Paul himself was in the choir at St. Bernard's up to the age of 10 and was taken to do a concreting job with his dad on a Saturday morning, age 10, and missed, because he used to sing in the choir at Mass every week, and he missed a big one, you know, weddings, everything. He missed a big one, which was the ordination of a priest. And got kicked out of the choir for that, you know, St. Bernard's. And then even went on a Catholic retreat as a teenager to Bollington in Cheshire for 3 days, as he put it in the book, just to get away from me dad. Terry, so it was all there.
Thank you so much, Terry Christian. I'm not going to be able to get over the Aldi version of Lourdes anytime soon, but it's just turned 7:30, still to come this morning. The latest on the hostage situation in Gaza, as 6 bodies are recovered and identified. We got another sign of the thawing in the Catholic Church's relationship with the Chinese government this week. A 95-year-old bishop from the unofficial or underground church in China was finally recognised by the state. Bishop Melchior Shi Hongzhen spent the past 5 years under house arrest because he refused to join the government-sanctioned version of the Catholic Church. He has now been recognised by the government as the Bishop of Tianjin in northern China. The Vatican clearly sees this as a win for its diplomacy, an outworking of the 2018 agreement signed between the Holy See and the Chinese government, an agreement that has never been made public but which is up for renewal next month. That secrecy, incidentally, has worried many Catholics in China and beyond, who fear that the Vatican may have privately agreed to mute its criticisms of the Chinese communist regime as the price for progress. One of the most vocal critics of that agreement is Samuel Chu, a pro-democracy campaigner from Hong Kong, now living in the United States.
I think the church, on one hand, has been historically very patient. I think I agree with that, because they feel like that we have been here for 1,000 years and will be here for another 1,000 years. Because regime change, people get elected, people get voted out of office, people die. But in China, what the Vatican has come upon is this immovable force, because the Chinese Communist Party and also believe that they're going to be this way for the next 1,000 years. You have now sort of a two immovable objects. And I think that that's a different kind of negotiation that the Vatican has gotten itself into. I'm originally from Hong Kong. You know, the Chinese government signed a deal that was going to keep Hong Kong unchanged for 50 years. 27 years in, they've ripped that up. And I think that that shows the validity or the value and how much you can trust in an agreement.
Well, to understand how the 2018 agreement works in practice, we turn to the theologian Martin Palmer, who's also an expert on religion in China.
The benefit to the Vatican is that it solves a long-running sore, which is that since the 1950s, following China becoming a communist country, the Vatican was thrown out of China, but the Catholic Church was allowed to continue as a Chinese organization, self-governing, self-funding, self-ruling. But the Vatican had no right of appointment of bishops or clergy or archbishops. And so for a long time, there was an underground church that secretly kept contact with the Vatican. Secretly, the Vatican agreed that people could be made bishops. But this was a very unsatisfactory situation. It meant they had to hide, and there was this official church that had nothing to do with the Vatican. The 2018 agreement basically brought those two churches together, got rid of the history, if you like, of people being appointed without the approval of the government or without the approval of the Vatican. They were melded together, and that problem was solved, sort of. From the Chinese perspective, they're very realistic about religion. They know that it's immensely powerful. They know the Catholic Church is immensely powerful. So it brought together two worlds, which, and this is interesting, William, at no point in history has there been even 1% of an overlap between the Han Chinese as the largest ethnic group in the world and the Catholic Church as the largest religious institution in the world. So an interesting moment in which both sides recognise the importance of the other.
And yet what looks like a pragmatic solution, which has the potential of a win-win outcome for the Catholic Church and the Chinese government, is obviously seen by some Catholics as a betrayal by the Vatican of Chinese Catholics. Why?
Essentially because the deal at the moment is pretty much one-sided. It is definitely to the advantage of the Chinese government, in that they've dealt with a kind of niggling underground movement by incorporating it. They have, in a sense, subjected the Chinese Catholic Church to becoming under the government of China, which in Catholic thinking worldwide is a problem. I mean, the tradition of Catholic thought is from the Middle Ages that rulers derived their authority from God, and that was mitigated to them by the Pope. And therefore, there is this real struggle between, well, who's in charge?
So historically, we have rather seen this movie before in terms of the yes. recognition of authority within the Church and its relationship with political powers. How then, how do you rate the significance of this latest bishop being consecrated?
Well, he's a tough old bloke, I have to say. Bishop Melchior Shi Hongzhen, 95. Remarkable man. And what he's done is he's managed to get his appointment to be a legal civil appointment, not an episcopal appointment. So he's kind of been able to fudge this. He's been able to keep his loyalty to the Pope, but also be a loyal citizen of China. Is it long term? I don't know. I mean, Samuel was talking about, you know, the Catholic Church being there for at least 1,000 years, and the Chinese Communist Party saying we'll be here for 1,000 years. Yes, for the Catholic, no, for the Chinese. I'm a student of Chinese history. In 400 years' time, when you take down a 300-page volume of the history of China, you will find the Chinese Communist Party dynasty will be pages 210 to 233. There will be many other dynasties after. So it's a temporary measure with what is effectively a temporary political structure that itself is undergoing considerable change and shift. And if you like, it's the old tradition, we're going to outlive this. Let's just keep going as best we can. It's very pragmatic. It's not dramatic, but it is kind of working, and it is making life just that little bit easier. Not completely easy, but that little bit easier to be a Catholic in China today.
You can just hear the Pope saying to his cardinals, guys, this too shall pass.
Very much so.
The encyclopedic Martin Palmer there. And for more on that complex relationship between Rome and Beijing, check out the Inquiry on the BBC World Service. You can find it on BBC Science with the episode, Is Pope Francis Betraying Chinese Catholics? Few novelists today can write about spirituality, theology, faith, and the sacred that encircles us, quite like Marilynne Robinson. Her masterpiece, Gilead, published 20 years ago, explores the theological struggles of an aging white Congregationalist minister in a small town in Iowa. Like the theologian she most admires, the 16th century reformer John Calvin, Marilynne Robinson is all about grace, and she's all in with providence. It is to that God of providence she turns in her new book. It's not a novel this time, but a reading, her own reading of the first book of the Bible, Genesis. This biblical book is not only the origin text for the Abrahamic faiths, it's also foundational for much of our Western literature.
Genesis really establishes the character of God for the purposes of the Bible. And considering how many cultures and religions and so on are influenced by that, it seems as if it has to be re-examined. I mean, the documentary hypothesis in most of its variations makes the beginning of Genesis, rather than the most spectacular poem in ancient literature, into a something indecipherable, something accidentally clapped together out of spare parts, you know. And I think even from a literary point of view, that is simply not something to be left alone.
So you want to recapture this as a piece of literature as a whole?
Yes. I mean, I can only do that because it is, in fact, there to be found. Mm. You know, I mean, I think that our literature proceeds from the Bible in a very great degree. It really becomes serious when the printed Bible becomes widely available. And I think we take a great deal stylistically from the Bible, but then it seems embarrassing to go back and find that it is in fact there, as if we're retrojecting modern assumptions on an ancient text.
When we go into the world of Genesis itself, or the worldview, the flood narrative, for example, is a story created to make sense of the world these people experienced. I'm taken by the fact that many people find themselves in an argument with the God who is depicted in Genesis, with God deposed as vengeful and capricious and self-involved. But your book, your reading Genesis book, is not a courtroom. You are approaching this depiction of God in a very different way.
Yes, that was certainly my intention. People seem to be very attached to the idea of God as vengeful. If you criticize the idea, criticize the language that has embedded it in the text and so on, people are, they're really, they like it the old way, you know? Yeah. They like God to be scary and particularly perhaps inclined toward vengeance against people who have offended them. I don't know. But in any case, the text does not support that understanding of God, and it seems to me that that's a serious theological problem.
Are you too forgiving of what is said of God in the text, though? Because there are people who read these accounts, like, for example, the flood narrative. You find in there a kind of evidence of God's commitment, particularly to forgiveness, the restoration of humanity, the multiplication of humankind. Others see in there a story of genocide and ethnic cleansing.
Since the destruction that's described in the narrative is so general, it's hard to describe it as ethnic cleansing. It's just human, you know, it's
species
just wiping
cleansing.
The.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. But my reading depends on being aware of the Babylonian texts that lie behind it, and typically that is not how it is looked at. And fundamentalist readings, which are very characteristic, that simply do not want to say they're taking an idea from another culture and scrutinizing it and modifying it and articulating it as something that states their worldview rather than the worldview of the culture they took it from.
And I suppose that's where you get the ethical question, isn't it? If you believe the flood actually happened, it was historical, or if you believe some of the other things that God is said to have done in the Bible actually happened and are historical, you have an ethical problem there, don't you? What kind of God would do that kind of thing? What kind of person would do that kind of thing? So I wonder if the absence of an ethical question for you comes from the fact that you see this as a kind of fiction. It has a purpose, but it's not to be read as historical.
No, it's not. It's historical in a very complex sense. Is understandable as rooted in a period and place, but it's not historical in the sense that it can be literally understood as describing things that happened, like yesterday's newspaper, you know?
Can I ask you a question as a writer, as a great writer? What do you make of the way Genesis is put together? Do you think it could do with a good editor?
I would say no, actually, but then I have a little problem with editors. But then, no, I think it's very, very well put together, especially, I mean, anything that is not absolutely modern, I think, compares invidiously, you know, to the economy of Genesis.
Yes.
You know, I mean, that you find little details in there, like Jacob's sons don't want to look at each other. And so, you know, these wonderful little characterizing moments. The efficiency is astonishing. I have had this kind of, I mean, I don't know how many years ago I told my editor that I was going to write about the Old Testament, precisely because I wanted to draw attention to what I saw as very important literary forms and so on. And he agreed, and he gave me an advance, you know, and so many years passed that I forgot that he had given me the advance. I forgot that I owed him a manuscript. And I thought, finally, I mean, because I'm a little bit practical, that if I was going to write it, I'd better write it, you know.
And write it she did. Marilyn Robinson on her new book, Reading Genesis. The news came this morning that the bodies of six hostages taken on the 7th of October have been found in a tunnel in southern Gaza during military operations there. Amongst them, the 23-year-old American-Israeli citizen Hirsch Goldberg-Pollen, whose family has now confirmed his identification. His mother, Rachel, you may remember, has been a regular guest on Sunday talking about their campaign to secure Hirsch's release and also to secure a hostage deal over the many past months. Let's get the latest from our correspondent John Donison, joining us from Jerusalem. John, good morning to you. What do we know at this point about the circumstances of these finds of the bodies?
Morning. Well, the Israeli military say they were discovered in a tunnel underneath the southern Gazan city of Rafah. The dead hostages have been named as the Israelis Alexander Lobanov, Almog Sarusi, Eden Yerushalmi, Ori Danino Carmelgat, and the American citizen you mentioned there, Hirsch Goldberg-Pollen. Now, Israel's chief military spokesperson, Daniel Hagari, has said that they had been brutally murdered by Hamas shortly before they were discovered.
What is the IDF saying, if anything, this morning, John, about the military operations that were going on in the region, in the Rafah area, when these bodies were located?
Well, you'll remember that earlier this week, Bedouin Arab hostage who was being held in Rafah was discovered in a tunnel there and managed to be brought out alive. And I think the Israeli military has been carrying out searches in these tunnels. And it seems like today, I think it was yesterday when the bodies were discovered, they came across these bodies. It's not exactly clear in the circumstances in which they died, but they were certainly captured alive. And as I say, Israel's military saying they had just been murdered by Hamas.
John, can you update us on what's been happening in the West Bank with these raids by the IDF there and calls by the United Nations leaders and others for a de-escalation?
Yes, well, for 4 or 5 days now, Israel has intensified its operations in the West Bank. It says they are counter-terrorism operations. They've been targeting at least 4 Palestinian cities, Jenin, Tulkarem, Tubas and Nablus, and 20 people have now been killed, according to Palestinian health officials. It's an ongoing situation. There was still strikes and the sound of explosions in Jenin yesterday, and we've heard overnight that in the occupied West Bank, 3 Israeli police officers have been shot dead in an attack near the Palestinian city of Hebron. So it's stuff going on in Gaza, but also increasingly in the West Bank too.
John, thank you very much. John Donison there. And as I say, for the past year, we've stayed in touch with Rachel Goldberg as she and her husband John have campaigned for the release of their son Hirsch. Rachel took that campaign around the world. She met the Pope. She addressed the United Nations in Geneva, spoke with Kamala Harris at the White House, all in an effort to encourage a hostage release deal. A proof of life video was released in April of this year featuring her son Hirsch, which did give the family some hope, as you can imagine, but tragically, Hirsch's body was found in that tunnel in Rafah, as we're reporting this morning. When we first talked a month after Hirsch was taken, Rachel told us how she, as a mother, was trying to cope with his abduction.
Well, first of all, I would just like to add that the video that we saw of Hirsch, of my son, being kidnapped by Hamas, was after they attacked a roadside bomb shelter that all of these young, you know, barefoot, crunchy granola hippies were attending. They threw hand grenades, an RPG was fired inside, and machine gun bullets were sprayed into this small fortified room right before Hirsch was loaded onto the truck to be kidnapped. we have the video from Anderson Cooper, who found it and through CNN gave it to us. Hirsch's arm, his left arm, was blown off from the elbow down. He is left-handed. So in addition to being terrified, as any parent would be, we also know that Hirsch has a grave injury. And today is day 30 and we know nothing, but we have a video of him with a stump where his arm used to be. And it really is not describable, actually. Everyone asks and says, I can't imagine what you're going through. And the answer is, we also can't imagine what we're going through. We're living in a completely alternate universe. And to try to begin to explain the depth of the trauma, the slow motion trauma that we are experiencing, is actually like describing to someone who's been blind their entire life and never had vision what the color pink is. It's not, I'm not capable of explaining to you what it is that we're going through.
Rachel Goldberg, who got the heartbreaking news this morning that her son's body has now been recovered. Just a few minutes ago, United Nations agencies in Gaza began delivering a mass polio vaccination campaign. As the biggest aid agency in Gaza, UNRWA is one of the agencies coordinating that programme. UNRWA's spokesperson Juliette Tuma joins us now from Jordan. Good morning, Juliette. Good to have you with us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
This is a vast scale of a vaccination programme in any circumstances, but in a war zone with some localised pauses, it's very dangerous work, to say the least.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Look, it's very welcome. I just received some footage and photos from a clinic that UNRWA manages of people queuing up nicely. And those two precious drops are now being given to boys and girls under 10. And we really do hope that this will work. We're in a race against time to vaccinate 600,000 children under the age of 10 across the Gaza Strip.
How much time do you have?
Well, look, we are starting today. We're starting in what we call the middle area. So that's like central Gaza, if you wish, from today until the 4th. And then the plan is to move south for another 3 days and then north for another 3 days. So we have approximately 10 days to reach 600,000 kids. And for that to happen, we need parties to the conflict to respect this agreement of area pauses. And to allow our teams to move safely, to allow people to come to our clinics and give their children this vaccine.
And Juliette, could you remind us why it is so important to vaccinate children against polio, which I think has not been detected in that region for some, 25 years or so?
You're absolutely right. It's very alarming that polio has returned to Gaza. And I think what's even more alarming is how quickly the virus has come back. I worked in other conflict zones, for example, in Syria, where it took 3.5 years of a brutal, brutal war to have polio come back. And even then, it was shocking for us. And here, it only took just over 10 months. So absolutely critical that every child in Gaza, but also in Israel, get the vaccine, because polio doesn't know borders or party lines or fighting lines. Mm. It doesn't need a visa to cross. And if we don't vaccinate every child, then the risk of more children getting the virus and being paralyzed for life still looms.
It makes a big difference, though, if you have available local healthcare services, doesn't it?
No, exactly. And this is why we have deployed our teams, UNRWA teams. We're working very closely with UNICEF, with the World Health Organization. We have our clinics, but we also have mobile teams. We have teams who are moving from tent to tent, from shelter to shelter, to reach children. It's a very cumbersome operation because people are moving all the time, or rather they're being forced to move due to these Israeli authorities' evacuation orders. And it's a sky full of airstrikes and it's a war zone. So it is very difficult to reach children under the circumstances, but we'll do everything possible to reach children.
In just 10 or 15 seconds, if you would, Juliette, what's your other big ask, politically, I suppose, internationally, for the children of Gaza?
A ceasefire.
It's as simple as that.
Absolutely. A ceasefire, it's about time, it's overdue, it's for the sake of every child in Gaza, Israel, across the region, a ceasefire.
Juliet, thanks very much. UNRWA's spokesperson, Juliet Tuma. That is it for this week's Sunday. You can email us to sunday@bbc.co.uk, listen again on BBC Sounds, or say hello to us on social media at BBCR4Sunday. Edward Stoughton's in the chair next Sunday. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.
That was William Crawley. Sunday was produced by Catherine Murray and Linda Walker. Now, Claire Balding makes the Radio 4 appeal on behalf of Access Sport.
It's the Paralympic Games in Paris this week. 12 days of elite sport from the world's finest athletes. It's a much needed positive representation of disabled people. An event I just love presenting, and I've worked on it since 2000, so 24 years. And it's a reminder that taking part in sport changes lives. Everyone's lives, mine included. I was definitely influenced hugely by growing up, learning to ride ponies and horses and falling off and having to get back on again. And I genuinely think it's helped me cope with life in general. But there are still barriers that disabled people face when trying to be active. Research says only one in four disabled people in England have the opportunity to be as active as they want to be. So that's too many people missing out on all that sport brings, the mental health benefits, the life skills, and that wonderful sense of belonging to a team. And this is what Access Sport wants to change. It's warm-up time at Safe Haven Basketball Club in London. This club holds sessions for disabled young people aged between 14 and 25, including Grace, who has autism. Growing up in America, Grace fell in love with the game, spending all her time on court. Basketball gave her an emotional outlet and helped her forge friendships. But when her family moved back to London, there wasn't an inclusive club for her to go to. And that's why her mum, Emma, decided to set one up. Emma reached out to Access Sport, and the charity covered the cost of booking basketball courts and paid for experienced coaches to run regular sessions. As experts in community sport, they also provided training and support for Emma, always being there to answer any questions she might have. 8 years on, Safe Haven has expanded, with three locations hosting around 50 disabled young people every week. This is one of over 500 clubs Access Sport supports across the UK. Your donation today will help keep these clubs open to disabled young people. To donate, just search online for BBC Radio 4 Appeal or call 0800 404 8144. Or you can write a cheque to Access Sport and send it to Free Post, BBC Radio 4 Appeal. That's the whole address. Free Post, BBC Radio 4 Appeal. And importantly, please mark the back of your envelope with Access Sport. Thank you so much.
That was Claire Balding. The number again, 0800 404 8144. Calls are free from landlines and mobiles. You can find details for giving online if you search for BBC Radio 4 Appeal. If you're a UK taxpayer and you want Access Sport to collect gift aid on your donation, include an email or postal address so they can send you a gift aid declaration. A look at the weather forecast now. Here's Simon King.
Thank you. Good morning. Yeah, it's looking pretty mixed today across the United Kingdom. We've got some heavy and thundery downpours moving their way through the English Channel at the moment, and they will affect some parts of England and Wales today. In southwest, southeast England, eastern England and across the Midlands, it's pretty cloudy this morning. We've got some heavy showers already around the Cambridgeshire area, moving their way a bit further northward into southern parts of Lincolnshire at the moment. But as we go through the next few hours, we'll see another batch of particularly heavy thundery downpours moving their way in across central southern parts of England. We could see some frequent lightning, gusty winds and quite a lot of rainfall in a short space of time. That could lead on to some localised flooding. These heavy thundery downpours will continue to move their way northward into parts of the Midlands later on this morning. Temperatures getting to about 22 to 25 degrees, but as we get a bit of sunshine developing across parts of southwest England, eastern and southeast England into the afternoon, temperatures in the southeast could be as high as 29 Celsius. Now for Wales and Northern England, pretty cloudy. We've got a couple of showers affecting the far south of Wales at the moment. Those move northward. As we go through today, there'll be some sunny spells developing across West Wales into northeastern areas of England. But in northwest England, this is where we'll see further heavy, potentially thundery showers moving in later this afternoon. Temperatures getting to 19 to 22 Celsius. For Northern Ireland, a few bright spells, but mostly cloudy. It should stay dry with highs of 16 to 18. And across Scotland, a few showers this morning in southern Scotland, staying cloudy here with heavy and thunderous showers possible here later in the day. Drier in northern Scotland, however, with some sunshine and top temperatures across Scotland getting to about 16 to 21 Celsius.
That was Simon King at 9 o'clock here on BBC Radio 4, its broadcasting house. Paddy O'Connell's here. Paddy, what's on the programme this morning?
Well, why is it so dark in here, Richard?
The bulbs have gone, apparently.
The bulbs
have gone. We've logged a call.
The bulbs have gone. Yes. Well, why don't we call the head of bulbs? Let's call the BBC's head of bulbs, and then it can be fixed in a year. Good morning, Richard.
Morning.
And hello, good morning to you. Well, goodbye to all that. It's the 1st of September, I think, today. We'll say goodbye to the summer, the election, remember that? The Euros, the riots, and Brat. Listeners trade their smartphone for a dumb one, and ahead of the Grenfell Report, residents of the recent Dagenham blaze will talk to us, and we'll begin with the news from Gaza.
BBC News at 8 o'clock on Sunday, the 1st of September. Good morning, this is Tom Sanders. Israel says it's recovered the bodies of six hostages in Gaza who were killed just before its forces were about to reach them. Voters in eastern Germany are heading to the polls for state elections that could deliver record success for the far-right AfD party. Airports across Europe are bringing back rules on liquids in hand luggage. Israel's military has recovered the bodies of six hostages from southern Gaza. They were among more than 250 hostages taken during the 7th of October attacks. A mass polio vaccination campaign is also getting underway in Gaza. The UN is hoping to reach 640,000 babies and children during localised pauses in the fighting. With the latest, here's our correspondent in Jerusalem, John Donison.
The dead hostages have been named as Israelis Alexander Lobanov, Almog Sarusi, Eden Yerushalmi, Ori Danino, Carmel Gat and Hirsch Goldberg-Polin, who was also an American citizen. Israel's chief military spokesperson, Daniel Hagari, said they had been brutally murdered by Hamas shortly before they were discovered in a tunnel below Rafah. A forum which represents hostage families said they were in mourning, but criticised the Israeli government, saying those found would still have been alive if ministers had pushed harder for a ceasefire and hostage release deal. Meanwhile, a pause in fighting has begun in central Gaza to allow a mass polio vaccination programme to begin. And in the occupied West Bank, three Israeli police officers have been shot dead in an attack near the Palestinian city of Hebron.
The Russian Ministry of Defence has said it has shot down 158 Ukrainian drones aimed at targets in Russia. Debris from the drones caused fires at an oil refinery in Moscow and a major power plant northwest of the city. There are no reports of injuries and the extent of damage isn't clear. Ukraine has yet to comment. Voting has just started in two elections in eastern Germany, where the far-right AfD party is expected to perform strongly. It's anti-immigration, wants to replace the euro with the Deutschmark and oppose the national government's approach to the war in Ukraine and climate change. One of the polls is taking place in Thuringia. Our correspondent Jessica Parker is in the state capital, Erfurt.
These are regional, not national elections. Regardless, the result could be seismic. Polls suggest that the far-right Alternative for Deutschland is leading in Thuringia and running a close second in Saxony. But because the AfD is viewed by many as extremist, an absence of willing coalition partners is likely to keep it from power. In Thuringia, the party is headed by a highly controversial figure, Bjorn Höcker. He's a talisman of the AfD's hard right and was fined twice this year for knowingly using a Nazi slogan, which he denied. Predictions also suggest the vote could be a major repudiation of the three parties governing Germany under Chancellor Olaf Scholz.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has again defended the government's decision to cut winter fuel support for around 10 million pensioners in England and Wales. The payments, worth up to £300, will be given only to those on pension credit or other means-tested benefits. Ms. Reeves said the policy would help put the country's finances on a firmer footing. Here's our political correspondent, Nick Eardley.
When Parliament returns tomorrow, it will be against the bleak backdrop of a Prime Minister warning of tough decisions to come. Some Labour MPs have told the BBC they fear the government is being too gloomy and not talking enough about the positive measures it plans to take. There is particular concern about the winter fuel payment. MPs have told the BBC they think the government has misjudged the situation and that some sort of mitigations for pensioners not on benefits will have to be announced. The Treasury is likely to extend a hardship scheme which gives councils in England funding to help with the cost of living. But the Chancellor, as things stand, isn't budging. She writes in today's Observer that it was a tough choice she did not want to make, but was essential to put the country on a firmer footing. Rachel Reeves is also warning there are more tough choices on spending, welfare and tax to come in the budget next month.
Scotland's First Minister John Swinney will promise to focus on what he'll call the people's priorities when he addresses the SNP conference in Edinburgh this afternoon. He's expected to say that the most important tasks include ending child poverty, reaching net zero, delivering strong public services and boosting growth. Surrey Police says it's working to establish exactly how three children and a man died at a house in Staines-upon-Thames. Their bodies were discovered yesterday afternoon. Detectives believe no one else was involved. Airports across Europe, which had scrapped 100 millilitre liquids limits for liquids in hand luggage, have been told that they must put the restrictions back in place from today. The European Commission says the reintroduction is a temporary measure to address a technical issue with new equipment. The UK took a similar step earlier this summer. Here's our transport correspondent, Katie Austin.
Some European airports, such as in Rome and Amsterdam, had already brought in high-tech scanning machines which should allow liquids limits to be eased and laptops to be left in bags. But now no airports in the EU will let people take liquids through security in containers larger than 100 millilitres. Announcing what it described as the temporary measure in late July, the European Commission said a technical issue needed to be fixed. The UK enacted a similar reversal in June. Some regional airports had already relaxed their rules but were suddenly told to bring back the 100 milliliter limit with no end date given. The Department for Transport said it was working with manufacturers, airports and international partners to lift restrictions when possible.
The organisers of the Paralympics in Paris have postponed the triathlon events that were due to take place in the River Seine because of concerns about the water quality. Officials hope to run them tomorrow. As Paul Serres reports, there's still plenty of competition to look out for.
There are 64 gold medal events at the Paris Games today. The British pair of Neil and Laura Fackey will be hoping to repeat their exploits from 3 years ago in Tokyo, where the married couple won gold within 16 minutes of each other. Laura in the individual pursuit B and Neil in the men's time trial B, with pilot Matt Rotherham. Lauren Rolls will be hoping for a third Paralympics title, going in the mixed double sculls in the para-rowing with partner Greg Stevenson. At the Stade de France, the world record holder Sabrina Fortune goes in the F20 shot put, and the wheelchair sprinter Hannah Cockcroft will race for her fourth consecutive T34 100-metre title.
That's the news. Time for a look at the Sunday papers. And the Sunday Times leads on a warning from the Education Secretary that parents are significantly denting their children's future earning potential by letting them skip school. Bridget Phillipson is quoted as saying she will act decisively to tackle what she called an absence epidemic. The paper highlights government analysis that suggests every day missed from the classroom costs children hundreds of pounds in wages over their lifetime. The Sunday Telegraph says teachers' unions have told Ms. Phillipson to scrap exams on times tables as part of a review of the curriculum in England. It reports that ministers are also being asked to strip back tests on grammar to curb pupil anxiety. A union source questions whether primary school children really need to know about modal verbs and fronted adverbials. But the former Conservative Education Minister Nick Gibb says the changes would be a retrograde step. A government spokesperson says its review aims to strengthen core skills in reading, writing and maths. The Observer's front page focuses on a study indicating that most people expect to go private for routine health treatments because they believe they won't be able to get them quickly enough on the NHS. The findings are based on extensive focus group analysis conducted by Loughborough University on behalf of the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, which funds research into social policy. Harry asks former aides to help plot his return from exile, is the Mail on Sunday's headline. It says the Duke of Sussex is consulting people from his old life on how to mastermind a return from the US. The article says representatives from Prince Harry didn't respond to its request for comment. The Sunday Mirror says a new Netflix documentary about the serial killer nurse Lucy Letby will feature experts who've questioned her conviction. The paper says it will mean fresh agony for the families of the 14 babies she murdered or tried to kill. The article says Netflix and the production company ITN have not commented. Pubs warn of smoking ban violence is the headline on the front of the Sunday Express. It says landlords fear the government's proposed ban on outdoor smoking could turn beer gardens and terraces into flashpoints. The former Tory party chairman Richard Holden tells the Express the plan would put bar staff in the firing line of customers. Sir Keir Starmer says he's making the decision to reduce the burden on the NHS. Several papers pick up on the online scramble to buy tickets for the Oasis comeback tour. The Daily Star says millions of fans were left crying their hearts out in what it called a shambles supernova. Wonder Wales is the headline in The Sun on Sunday. It says there was fury from some fans who waited more than 10 hours to buy tickets, only for the booking websites to time them out. The paper's editorial takes aim at people reselling tickets at inflated prices. And that's our look at the Sunday papers.
Tom Sanders. After Dame Tanny Gray Thompson's experience crawling off a train this week, the sociologist and wheelchair user Tom Shakespeare reflects on his experience of crawling in A Point of View in 40 minutes here on Radio 4. After Sunday worship, which this morning comes from Northern Ireland and is led by members of the New Irish Youth Choir, directed by Jonathan Ray, the service begins with the song God So Loved.
Mercy. Good morning, and welcome to today's service, which is led and sung by the New Irish Youth Choir. You join us as we finish off our annual residential, which always ends with a concert.
Across our junior and senior youth choirs, we have 130 members, aged 10 to 18. Going on residentials gives us a chance to develop as musicians while making new friends who share the same interests. We work hard on the songs, but we also relax and have fun together with some crazy games, songwriting competitions, and a little bit of Zumba every morning.
But there's another dimension to what we do, because New Irish Youth Choir exists to encourage people to worship God. So our songs are focused on worship. And while we're on residential, we also do Bible studies and listen to talks that help us understand who God is and what he has done for us. Let's pray together as we begin today's service.
Lord, as we worship you today, we thank you for the world you have made and your deep care for every person in it. We praise and honour you because you are mighty and powerful, but you are also full of grace. And so we come before you in humility, confessing our sins, knowing that you have promised to forgive us for the bad things we should not have done and for the good things that we did not do. We thank you that your mercy is new every day and that we can trust in your forgiveness. Help us this day to honour you with our words and deeds and to trust in you for everything. And whether we are in trouble or on top of the world, help us to know that our security is in you and that in you we can find true rest. May all who hear this service be encouraged and blessed. Amen.
As we embark on the start of a new academic year, I fondly recall how in my childhood my father used to love to tease me at this time of the year by pointing out the back-to-school signs in the shops. I still remember those reluctant days out with my mother, where after playing for weeks in the sunshine in my shorts, we would go to buy the new uniform, stationery, lunchbox and all the other paraphernalia that the school told us was essential for the term ahead. But of course my parents were doing this primarily because they wanted me to be properly equipped. They didn't want me to have to go to school without the stuff I needed for school life. In today's service, we are going to explore how God, our Heavenly Father, equips us, not just for school life, but for the whole of our lives. Listen to the words of Peter.
By his divine power, God has given us everything we need for living a godly life. We have received all of this by coming to know him, the one who called us to himself by means of his marvelous glory and excellence.
Let's not miss the words of this promise. The Lord has given us everything we need to live a godly life. Now, often when we think about our needs, we tend to have quite temporary ideas about what will make our lives better. And so we long for things like money or education or good health. But today, we're going to look at three parts of the Bible that show us that when God meets our needs, he doesn't necessarily do it on our terms. Instead, he chooses to give us himself. He calls us to a deep relationship with him and then promises his unique presence with us, equipping us for life and godliness by being alongside us each and every day. We're going to hear a well-known story now from Mark's Gospel. It's about a time when the disciples of Jesus thought he had totally lost the plot, but then they ended up learning an important lesson about his authority and how Jesus' power can equip us for life.
As evening came, Jesus said to his disciples, "Let's cross to the other side of the lake." So they took Jesus in the boat and started out, leaving the crowds behind. But soon a fierce storm came up,
high waves were breaking into the boat, and it began to fill with water. Jesus was sleeping at the back of the boat with his head on a cushion. The disciples woke him up, shouting, "Teacher, don't you care that we're going to drown?" When Jesus woke up, he rebuked the wind and said to the waves, "Silence, be still." Suddenly the wind stopped and there was a great calm. Then he asked them, "Why are you afraid? Do you still have no faith?" The disciples were absolutely terrified. "Who is this man?" they asked each other. "Even the wind and waves obey him."
One of the reasons why I love this story is because of the entirely understandable angst in the behaviour of the disciples. They did what I often do when I'm worried about something. They identified the problem and then multiplied it by making the assumption that nobody cared about their plight. But they had momentarily forgotten who they were with. For when the disciples saw that storm, their basic instinct was to panic. But when Jesus saw it, he just told it to go away. And miraculously, it did. And everyone who witnesses this miracle is suddenly shocked by the sheer power of Jesus. This group of people have been following him and watching his signs and wonders for some time. But this particular manifestation of his power gives them a newly elevated respect for his authority because they see that the natural world responds to his words. They thought that what they needed was a nice, calm night on the water, catch some fish, get safely home. But instead, they got to be part of an incredible drama in which Jesus taught them a much deeper lesson about himself. Authority isn't an especially popular concept in our society. Most of us have a basic reluctance to do as we are told. But there are definitely situations where we need someone to take control. We all know what it is to be quiet during the safety demonstration in an aircraft. And those disciples knew enough at the start of the evening to know that they needed to get Jesus' help when that storm took hold. But they were full of unnecessary anxiety, and they even accused him of not caring about them. They couldn't have been more wrong. As Christians get to know Jesus, we ought to trust his authority more. And in this story, we're reminded that when we are full of panic and anxiety, his capacity to save us far exceeds the wildest horizons of our imagination. His authority is without question, and he can calm the storms in our minds. What a comfort it is to be under the authority of one who is there for us, to give us everything we need. The Bible teaching on our choir residential this year came from Ephesians chapter 6, where Paul uses a wonderful metaphor to show us how to be resilient in the Christian life and to live in victory when our faith is under attack.
Put on the full armour of God, so that when the day of evil comes, you may be able to stand your ground, and after you have done everything, to stand. Stand firm then, with the belt of truth buckled around your waist, with the breastplate of righteousness in place, and with your feet fitted with the readiness that comes from the gospel of peace. In addition to all this, take up the shield of faith, with which you can extinguish all the flaming arrows of the evil one. Take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God.
The context in which Paul wrote this letter is interesting. He was in prison for telling people about Jesus. But rather than go quiet, he chose to spend his time writing to young churches to inspire them in their faith. This God-inspired metaphor is often used to encourage developing Christians in their faith, even though few of us actually get to see anyone in a suit of armour on a regular basis. It's entirely possible that Paul may have written this under the watchful gaze of a fully helmeted Roman soldier. And because our circumstances are quite different, we might find the metaphor about armour a little distant from our own lived experience. But it is a helpful picture when we understand that the images of the swords and the breastplates are not the principal point. They simply represent the much more valuable resources that God has given us. He gives us faith to carry with us, to defeat the enemy of doubt. He gives us the gospel of peace so that we can spread it to other people. He gives us the Holy Spirit, who speaks to us through the Bible with his full authority. And he defends us with truth and righteousness. Again, we see that God has given us everything we need for life and godliness. And because of this, we can be passionate in the pursuit of justice and truth, standing firm as followers of Jesus. We can assert our reliance on the resources that God has provided and stand confident in the faith, because we know that God will keep his promises.
I've been a-walking with the Lord for many a day. Nothing gonna stumble my feet. Trying to abide in the straight and narrow way. Nothing gonna stumble my feet. But when my time on earth is done, and I hear my name. Oh, when my time on earth is done, these weary feet are gonna run. Not gonna stand, not gonna trip, not gonna stumble. No, I'm not gonna slip. No, nothing gonna stumble my feet. When I go to walk that golden street, now the devil is a liar
and a cheater too.
Nothing's gonna stumble my feet. And if he gets his way,
he'll make a slider out of you.
Stumble my feet. But if you listen for the Spirit's voice in the moment of truth. Oh, if you listen for the Spirit's voice, he'll help you make the right choice. I'm not gonna stammer, not gonna trip,
not gonna stumble.
No, I'm not gonna slip. No, nothing gonna stumble my feet. When I go to walk that golden street,
not gonna waver,
falter, sway or fall.
Gonna stumble or slide.
stumble at all.
The final example of God providing for our needs takes us to the defining moment in history where Jesus was executed on a shameful cross. Of course, the cross is that central symbol of the Christian faith which carries so much meaning. People often wear crosses as jewellery to identify themselves with Jesus. But let's revisit the scene to explore once again how the cross is another moment of God providing us with everything we need for life and godliness. Listen to this incredible sentence, which again comes from the writings of Peter.
Jesus personally carried our sins in his body on the cross, so that we can be dead to sin and live for what is right. By his wounds you are healed.
Discussions about sin are never popular, and it can be easy for us not to notice the damage that sin does, or to ignore it. But the Bible pulls no punches about how severe our problem is. The God who loves us says that our sin will ultimately separate us from him, that it will lead us to death and destruction. The God who gives us everything we need to live life properly cannot tolerate sin. But the good news of the Christian gospel is that the same God sent his only Son to deal with our sin and give us new life. And by the wounds of Jesus on the cross, we are healed. Again, God is challenging our understanding. And instead of giving us the lollipops of short-term pleasure that we think we need, he gives us himself again, along with everything we need to live a godly life. Jesus personally carries our sins away through his death on the cross, and God is so pleased that sin is finally dealt with that he raises Christ to live forever as the object of eternal worship. What shall we do about this God who keeps on giving us himself? Our response to this question defines our lives. For we can walk away from God's repeated attempts to give us himself and find ourselves separated from him and all the hope he offers. Or we can choose to accept God's incredibly generous offer of new life, where he equips us with absolutely everything we need to enjoy his presence forever. The work is his, but the choice is ours.
See, on the hill of Calvary, my Savior bled for me. My Jesus set me free. Look at the wounds that give me life, grace flowing from his side. No greater sacrifice. What he's done, what he's done. All the glory.
Praise God for what he's done.
Let us pray. Thank you, God, for the gift of music and the pleasure of singing. Help us to remember that our voices are from you and always to honour you in the things we say and sing.
We pray for everyone in education at the start of this new term, and especially for young people who are anxious about starting a new school or university. Help us always to keep our desire to learn.
We ask for your protection from despair, for all who struggle with anxiety and other mental health issues. Give them confidence in your power that can help us with every aspect of our lives.
We pray for families who are finding things challenging at this time due to financial problems, health issues, or relational difficulties. We pray for the protection of all who are vulnerable. Be near to those who most need encouragement and help today.
We bring before you the situations of conflict in our world, where war is tearing families apart. Please equip those who are trying to find peaceful solutions which will save lives in dangerous places.
Christ the Lord be fast. Justice has been satisfied. He will hold me fast.
Thank you for being part of today's service. As you go about your day, may you reflect on God's promise to give you everything you need for life, and let your heart be full of singing. Amen.
Sing a song to the Lord, go on and lift your voice. Sing a song to the Lord and make a joyful noise. Sing a song to the Lord, go on and lift your voice. La 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 la, and make a joyful noise. La 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 la, la 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 la, la 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 la, and make a joyful noise. Sing a song to the Lord, go on and clap your hands. Sing a song to the Lord, go on your knees and dance. Sing a song to the Lord, go on and clap your hands. La 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 la, on your knees and dance. La 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 la, la 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 la, la 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 la, on your knees and dance. Clap your hands and stomp your feet. God made the whole world to sing. Fill our hearts with all His blessings and lift our voices above.
Sing a song to the Lord, don't shake your tambourine. Sing a song to the Lord and let your voices ring. Sing a song to the Lord, don't shake your tambourine. La 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 la, and let your voices
sing. Sing a song to the Lord ends Sunday worship from Northern Ireland. It was led by members of the New Irish Youth Choir, directed by Jonathan Ray. The producer was David Walker. Next week, Sunday Worship explores the ancient calling of religious life with the Reverend Richard Carter, leader of the Nazareth community at St Martin-in-the-Fields in London. This is Radio 4. Now, a point of view, a personal essay from a leading writer. Here's Tom Shakespeare.
This week,
Tanny Gray Thompson, the Paralympic gold medalist and member of the House of Lords, crawled off her train when it reached London because the assistant she had booked did not arrive. I followed stories of being left in train carriages over and over again. They're strikingly similar to Frank Gardner's tales of being left on planes. If you need to rely on people, and there are too few of them, and they aren't paid well, and it is badly organised, then the disability assistance doesn't work reliably. The goal is for you to be able to turn up and go on any train. But at the moment, it only works if you give 24 hours notice, and not even always then. If you have the temerity to change your plans, then it all breaks down. I know what it is to crawl. I've crawled off a few trains myself. Recently, I was forgotten on a train to an away day in Tring. Luckily, I was with a colleague, so I could wheel my wheelchair backwards out of the carriage and be caught by her as I dropped to ground level. That's team building for you. On that occasion, the train manager shouted at me that he had not known he should have provided a ramp. It was as if it was my fault for being a disabled passenger and needing it. But I booked help, I replied, weeks ago. I did it properly. Even Houston knew I existed an hour before. Unfortunately, someone forgot to tell the right staff. And what was possible for me by means of emergency crawling is not possible for all disabled people. At other times, I've ended up on the ground where my wheelchair crashes in a pothole in the pavement. I've done this several times this year. The first time, I'd been to see a great concert at the Royal Festival Hall, was enthusing to a friend as we made our way to Waterloo, and the next thing I knew, I was flat on my face, spitting out bits of gravel. To be honest, I wouldn't recommend it as an approach because copious quantities of blood are often involved. And I want to apologise to people on the number 59 bus. The only fight I had been in was with the ground. My holidays always seem to entail a lot of crawling. I've crawled in Egypt when I wanted to visit the Alexandria apartment of the poet Constantine Kavafi, who lived in a block without a lift. I don't think the generously mustachioed custodian got many visitors to the apartment, because he was rather surprised to see us. He promptly retired back to the kitchen, where he appeared to be mending a quantity of vacuum cleaners, while I saw the austere rooms where the writer thought and wrote and remembered. I've crawled in Italy, when I wanted to visit the childhood home of Antonio Gramsci, in Galeazzo, on the island of Sardinia. The famous 20th century communist revolutionary had stunted growth, possibly caused by childhood tuberculosis. I remember seeing the dumbbells his brother had made for him out of stone. In my case, I felt that crawling up to see the exhibition was quite enough exercise. Back home one evening, I was cooking tortellini for my supper, and had the pan simmering away on the stove. I began to drag it over to the sink where I could drain it, when I suddenly realised that I was in imminent danger of pouring boiling water all over myself. To avoid this calamity, and unable to control the weight, I threw the whole pan away from me, tortellini and all. A tidal wave of hot water splashed all around my kitchen. That night, I ate my supper off the floor. At least it had been sterilised. My favourite painter, Lucy Jones, has cerebral palsy. She lives in Ludlow, where I remember helping her in her beautiful allotment, a picture of which I've hung on my wall. She needs a walker to get around, which works fine on pavements and in galleries. But to see the Welsh landscape she paints, she has to crawl into a field with her sketchbook, where she works with pastels to capture the bright colours of the day. Imagine her point of view. More than a metre lower down than yours, among the worms and earwigs and mud. The whole world looks different from down there. No wonder we talk about getting a different perspective. Don't get me wrong, I'm not against crawling. Crawling certainly has its place. It does indeed give you a new viewpoint from which to see the world, as Lucy shows. Solidarity with babies and toddlers is what I say. But crawling generally happens when we are very young. If it happens later, it is usually because society has let us down, or because we have no choice, or occasionally because we're drunk. Crawling is no way for adults to go about their business. In these circumstances, crawling is a humiliating last resort, which is why I waved goodbye to my dignity some while back. Unfortunately, across the world, only 15% of people have the assistive devices which they need. Not only can they often not use public transport, they can't even wheel about their house or neighbourhood. Of course, now there is an organised disability movement which is determined to make a difference and to celebrate people like Franklin D. Roosevelt, who used a chair himself after polio, and indeed Tanny Gray Thompson and all the others. Our rights are never won without a struggle, and it seems as if we have to repeat that struggle on a regular basis. In order to get the 1990 Americans with Disabilities Act passed, activists in Washington crawled up the many steps of the Capitol. The Capitol crawl, as it became known, was a poignant symbol of exclusion. As a result of that pioneering civil rights legislation, discriminatory physical barriers were removed across the United States. Citizens with disabilities are still not equal, but they can go pretty much where you can go, as a right, and they don't have to do it on their hands and knees. The Americans with Disabilities Act was the prototype for anti-discrimination legislation around the world, including the 2006 United Nations Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. In the weeks of the Paralympics, it is frustrating beyond belief that nearly 30 years since our own Disability Discrimination Act, we are still at times forced to crawl because we have no other choice. We've moved beyond those days when we used only to travel in a guard's van or trains as if we were parcels, not people. But I get tired of repeating that too many disabled folk are struggling to survive because their benefits have been cut, or because they can't get a job, or because infrastructure is unreliable. And Britain is better than most countries. Remember this while you're watching brilliant athletes breaking records and showing what the human body is capable of over the next week. Most of these amazing sports people are going back to societies where they're reminded that they are second-class citizens and often not welcome to make demands on everybody else. This week, I took the train to Norwich to attend an event. I'd booked disability assistance out of habit, but when I went to the desk in the station, we agreed I didn't really need it. No, I hadn't suddenly been cured. I was still in the wheelchair. But for the first time since I became paralysed in 2008, I could just wheel onto the level access train. The system, at least in one part of England, had been cured. I didn't need anyone to come and help me with their ramp. I can't tell you how wonderful that felt. For the first time, I was just like everyone else. I nearly cried.
A Point of View was written and presented by Tom Shakespeare and produced by Adele Armstrong. Now, Tweet of the Day. The ornithologist Dominic Cousins is fascinated by the razorbill and the guillemot.
Razorbills and guillemots. It sounds like the name of a high street store. But this is a bird double act. These two species are usually found together at great seabird colonies, crowded on cliff ledges above the roaring waves. The guillemot is the adventurous one, packed together, shoulder to shoulder, on the narrowest of ledges. While the razorbill is the sensible one, finding a niche on a more capacious surface, and often with a roof. The guillemot performs mad ululations, while the razorbill has a far more relaxed sound, like the creaking of a ship's timbers. The razorbill is also much smarter looking, so boldly black and white that it could be wearing an expensive tuxedo. The chicks leave the nest in the same terrifying way, though. On evenings in late summer, its wings not yet fully grown, egged on by its father, the 20-day-old youngster simply leaps off a cliff into the water far below. It's a leap of faith.